you indicated that you were grappling with the problem, and that once things take shape, then you made the choice.
We will do a round of introduction so that we can hear some of the voices that are here. And thereafter we get straight into the program of the day. My name is Fred Gona. I'm the chairperson of the portfolio committee. And next to me is...
Faith Bikoni, a member of the committee.
Eric Nirema, member of parliament. Rose Sonda, a member of the committee.
Jack Lorimer, committee member. Andrew Kent, member of the committee.
Good morning, my name is Linda Jobo, member of the committee.
City on the committee from Solidarity. John Nelquarius Platinum.
Jonathan Ryan, Northern Platinum.
Roger Baker, Senior Executive, Chamber of Mines.
Savashni Govinda, Anglo American Platinum.
Albert Jameson from Lonmenchi, Commercial Officer.
Rudy DiCerco, Lonmen Platinum, Investor Relations.
Bruce Mabena, Senior Executive, Chamber of Mines.
Johan Saron from Impala Platinum.
Can we hear from you, madam? Madam Medrek, is this thing looking well?
Yes, I can let you know.
Can we hear from that, the people from that side?
Thank
you. Thank you very much. As I indicated, this meeting is long overdue, given the crisis in the platinum sector and the talk of restructuring in the sector, possibilities of job losses in the sector, and possibilities of mothballing of some of the operations within the platinum sector. We got concerned as the portfolio committee in parliament that we hear of the problems that are said to be developing in the platinum sector, knowing very well that this country is endowed with the world's platinum sector, platinum commodity, and that mining has played a pivotal role in the employment levels within the country. Historically and currently, they are playing that role. So therefore it became as a matter of concern. More so also to understand why is this the case. Because when you look at the price of the commodity, even as we speak today, it's sitting at the region of 1,600 per ounce, and it's been sustainably in that level. In the past 4 to 5 months, it was higher than that. You would expect that when the commodity price is at that level, at least there will be smooth running of operations in terms of production, in terms of sales, and in terms of job creation, which is the major issue that we need to be working on as a country. So hence we've requested you, the chamber and the companies, to please come and enlighten us on what is going on so that together we can then find a lasting solution. We know that you are engaging the government on the other level in terms of the Department of Mineral Resources on this very question, but we don't want to leave it for too long out of the realm of the parliament until such time that we are confronted with serious problems and challenges in that sector. So while it's starting, we need to then nip it in bud if it is all possible. So without further ado, we'll hand over to you, Chimba, to then lead us in the discussion. Thank you very much.
Honourable Chairperson, Mr. Gorner, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and present for the committee. It is a critical time for the platinum sector, and I think that's why in the statement today you've defined it as South Africa's platinum mining crisis, a crisis that is enveloping all of us in the platinum sector. We obviously appreciate your oversight role and your desire for jointly looking at joint problem-solving related ways of handling the very challenges the sector is facing. So, Honourable Chairperson, what I'm going to do is run through a set of slides.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you get color because it's difficult when you talk of the grass? I think I've made that request before that we must always get color, especially if there's going to be grass involved. Otherwise, I'm not going to follow up on it.
Yeah, we will certainly make the copies available. Unfortunately, the hotel only has a black and vibrant this morning, so a bit of a challenge. Just to quickly say that when we're looking at the presentation, what I'd like to do is just take everyone to the global platinum environment, so the global forces that are shaping the platinum industry, to look specifically at the South African platinum mining industry itself, to focus on the challenges facing the sector, and then taking a strategic perspective of the industry and how we can collectively manage the various challenges that the sector faces. So very much focus on what the challenges are, but also trying to look at what the various problems are that the industry is facing at the same time. So very much a sort of constructive problem-solving approach to different challenges. So if we go into the global platinum global environment and how it affects the platinum industry, Honourable Chairperson, your remarks were very important up front, which is saying, you know, what's been happening to the price, and I hope you'll be able to answer some of those questions on how price has been affected in the recent history. I think just to start off with, the prospects of platinum are mostly driven at a global level by economic growth, by investment demand and automotive sales and jewelry sales at the global level. But since 2008, since the global financial crisis hit the world, the platinum market has been hit by a set of global forces. These include the slide into recession of Europe, and it's actually been worse than people have anticipated. Europe in 2011 was the biggest platinum global market, particularly platinum, which is mostly a South African platinum group metal. By the slowdown of growth in China, so China's growth rates were sitting at 11% growth rates 4 years ago. They're now moderated to roughly about an 8% level. The continued below growth potential performance of the U.S. economy and on structural changes in the platinum market, specifically related to a very big increase in recycling of material, and I'll show that to you in a moment in relation to the impact that it's having on supply. The substitution and shifting of platinum and rhodium with palladium, in the way that catalytic converters, for example, are fabricated. The erosion of the rhodium market, and I'll touch on that a little later, and changes in demand away from the traditionally strong areas of industrial demand towards greater level jewelry demand. So just to highlight the global, some of the global forces. But 71% of the total platinum group metals, this is on slide number 3, 71% of platinum group metals are, on slide 4, are used for industrial purposes. That's auto catalysts, electrical, chemical industry, the glass industry, the petroleum industry, etc. So that is very much affected at the global level by what happens to growth rates, particularly in the key markets where platinum is consumed. That's mostly Europe and China. So just to highlight in slide 5, that a large portion of the market is located in the recession in Europe. Europe was the biggest market for platinum in 2011. China has now overtaken it. But in this particular slide, on slide 5, we can see that the red area is China, for obvious reasons. And that just shows that jewelry demand in China has been one of the big driving forces, whereas industrial demand, which mostly is in Europe and others, particularly in the catalytic converting industry for platinum, has obviously been hit by the recession in that country, in that region. Just moving on to the next slide, which is slide number 6, just to highlight, platinum growth has been stagnant. So if we look at the chart on the right-hand side, it shows total platinum demand by application, so that's chemical, electrical, glass, jewelry, etc. And you can see the effect of the global financial crisis, the dip that took place in 2009, the big fall of demand. But yes, overall demand in the last 3 years has actually been going sideways. It hasn't been improving. Now, South Africa does supply roughly 50% of the world's platinum supply. On the left-hand side, we're also demonstrating in the graph on the bottom left-hand side what's happened in the palladium market, where Russia is the dominant supplier, where we've seen demand having fallen off during the global financial crisis, but recovered back to higher than pre-crisis level, and that's why the palladium market has recovered farther than the platinum market itself. And there's a number of reasons for it. I think the big issue is that the platinum market has been negatively affected because of its large exposure to Europe and the recession in Europe, particularly in relation to catalytic converters, which are used in the diesel vehicles in Europe. Jewelry demand growth has been a positive force in China, and South Africa obviously is the main producer of platinum itself. But on the palladium market side, we've seen a degree of tilting towards greater use of palladium in catalytic converters, even in diesel vehicles. We've seen automotive sales in North America, Japan, and growth in China recover. Most of those are petrol vehicles, which use palladium as a catalyst. And so palladium has also benefited from the substitution away from platinum and rhodium towards palladium itself. And again, just to highlight, you know, Russia is the major producer. We only account for about 27% of the world's palladium supply compared to 50% for platinum and 52% for the rhodium market. Now, next slide is really an attempt to provide a sense of, compared to other commodities, if we look at nickel, iron ore, copper, for example, just to see how they've responded to the global recession, the global financial crisis. And you can see again, 2009, there was a very big fall-off in global GDP, the first recession in 61 years. But I think what's important about it is that you can see the recovery in the nickel, iron ore, copper markets was much more pronounced than the recovery in the platinum market. Obviously, going forward, the platinum market, hopefully over time, we should see some sort of recovery, but it's going to be much more of a longer-term recovery, and competing against the set metals that recovered much faster because they were very much more exposed to the Chinese model as opposed to the European market. So we are still sitting at below pre-crisis levels of demand for platinum in particular. On the next slide, which is slide number 8, what we've done here is just to look at the Eurozone and compare platinum demand in the Eurozone versus what platinum demand globally has done versus what the European GDP has done. And there's a very strong relationship because Europe has been such a concentrated market for platinum over time, and it just really illustrates that with Europe still being in recession, it's had a big impact on platinum demand at the global level. This highlights a significant issue for the, you know, for the South African sector, is that we're exposed to the European market, which is a big portion of platinum market in particular, and that market is still mired in recession. Last year's growth rate in Europe was a negative minus 0.5 cents, so still very much mired in recession, still very much constrained on a demand point of view, and the automotive sector is still quite weak in Europe. In fact, their growth rate towards the end of the year weakened further. So this is just highlights the impact that Europe has on the platinum market as a whole. Chairperson and honourable members, I think if we look at the platinum sector up until 2007, there was a very strong expectation that up until 2006, that the forecasted demand for platinum would grow somewhere above 5% per annum over the course of the next 5 years, from 2007 to 2012. I don't think anyone predicted global financial crisis hitting as hard as it did. Demand actually decreased by 0.5% between 2007 and 2012 versus growth in actual supply of over 5%. So effectively what had happened is that demand projections were high, the actual outcomes were low, but supply had been brought on stream to try and provide inputs into the market on the expectation that the global economy would be stronger than it actually was. But there's also been a fundamental shift in demand, and as I mentioned right at the beginning of the presentation, the demand historically has predominantly been at the industrial level, but we've now seen a shift towards jewelry demand, and jewelry demand is slightly different. It's more price sensitive compared to, for example, industrial demand. So if we take the auto-catalytic converter industry, vehicle manufacturers have been lowering their load levels. The automotive industry in Europe has been under challenge. There has been a bit of recovery in North America and obviously in China, continued growth, but that's mostly for the palladium side. But for the platinum side specifically, we'll be looking at obviously the weak European market has been a big challenge. And investment demand has also increased price volatility. I think the structural change that we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years in the platinum industry actually resulted in a decline, or compound annual growth rate decline of 1.7% from a South African perspective as other sources of supply at the global level also came on stream. So I think the point here is that companies expected that growth would be, demand would be a lot higher than it actually was, and a lot of production was planned and brought on stream, and that production obviously had made surpluses in the market, and I'll get into the detail of that in a moment. Just to highlight in this particular slide, which is on slide number 10, the yellow chart just shows you the very significant increase in recycling that's taken place, particularly over the last 5 years. In fact, recycling last year at 1.8 million ounces of platinum specifically was a very big component, as big as the second largest platinum producer in the world in terms of their supply that they're bringing onto market. So there's been a very big increase in recycling that's taken place, and that's obviously added to supply that came onto the global market. From South African perspective, our production has been shrinking a bit over the last couple of years, whilst other producers and cycling have gained. So at the global level, too much supply coming on stream. If you look at the factors then that tend to influence the platinum market on a pricing side, we've seen falling demand in some of the key markets, particularly in Europe, modest growth in supply at the global level, and this has resulted in surpluses. If we look at the two-year period between 2009 and 2011, in the platinum market alone, we saw a cumulative surplus of over 1 million ounces. Last year, we saw a strike-induced deficit of about 400,000, but cumulatively, we're still sitting at more than a 600,000-ounce surplus in the platinum market, and that's a bearing on price. It's had a mega bearing on weakening the price during the course of 2011 and 2012. And a bit of a modest recovery. If you go back to the pre-global financial crisis levels, the platinum price was sitting at above $2,000 per ounce. Last year, the average price was sitting at $1,556 per ounce. And there's been a modest recovery, as you mentioned earlier, into the sort of $1,600 level, but we'll demonstrate shortly the implications of that. One of the areas that I think is important to just dwell on for a moment is, and this is on slide number 12, whilst we have a platinum price which is flashed on the TV in the evenings, a platinum price which shows it's operating at maybe $1,600 or $1,700 per ounce, the actual production-weighted basket price, so in other words, the amount of, if you add up the price of palladium, rhodium, and platinum, and you apply a weighted average compared to the actual price that you're receiving and how much goods you are actually producing for platinum, palladium, and rhodium, the price is somewhat lower than the actual platinum price, because obviously companies are producing a basket of platinum group metals, they're not just producing platinum by itself. And so the result is the basket price is actually quite a bit lower, because obviously palladium prices are sitting at the $700 level, which is considerably below the platinum price level. So just to highlight that the basket price that we receive is not the $1,600 basket price or $1,700 basket price. It's considerably lower because of our production profile of the platinum, palladium, and rhodium that we produce as an industry and a country. So Jefferson, that's the summary of the sort of global issues that are affecting the global platinum sector. If we go into the actual platinum mining industry itself, platinum has now established itself as the larger component of South Africa mining sector. And that's why it's really a critically important component of the mining sector, not denigrating any of the other components of the mining sector, but it is the largest. It, on a direct, indirect, and juice basis, accounts for about 5.7% of GDP, about 2.7% directly. On the export earnings side, you include the export of platinum catalytic converters. South Africa does account for 30% of global supply of platinum catalytic converters. Platinum accounts for about 11% of our total merchandise exports. And the industry accounts directly for about 190,000 jobs, but if you add it into the rest of the economy, the number is closer to about 430,000 people are employed as a result of mining activities, of platinum mining activities. In 2011, the industry produced about 289 tons of platinum metal, valued at about $84 billion. We talked about the employment number already, 194,000 people directly, about $30 billion in wages, salaried wages. The industry, the top five companies paid about $7.3 billion in corporate tax, and about $500 in community investment in that year alone, excluding housing. And this is just maybe a bedtime reading chart that's designed for economists, because economists like confusing themselves with interesting sort of detailed tables which no one can read, so my apologies for that. But it's really just a graph showing the performance of the industry in terms of contribution to GDP, the growth rate of the sector in the last period, the GDP growth rate of the platinum sector being -1.2% per annum in the last 5 years. It's got export earnings, employment, wages paid for the top, for the industry as a whole, capital spend, tax spend, dividend spend, and some of the social contributions that the industry is making. So maybe that's all a later discussion, just to highlight the overall contribution it's making. If we can go to the challenges, because I think this is very much, Chairperson, Honourable Chairperson, and Honourable Members of the Committee that you want to focus on, but let's get into the challenges that are facing the industry. I think that the platinum mining industry is in crisis. It's been hit by a combination of factors. These factors include, and this is on slide 17, falling platinum demand, particularly for platinum and rhodium, whereas palladium is slightly recovered, but that's not our majority production side. Rapidly escalating input costs, and we'll get into more detail on each of these areas in a moment. We've seen some structural changes in the industry. We've seen an increased mining of UG2 ores away from the traditional Morenci Reef. We've seen poor productivity, and obviously covering the whole thing has obviously been the impact of the Eagle strike action last year. And if we take 2012 average price and costs, including sustaining CAPEX, which is the CAPEX you spend just to keep operations going at the current levels, we're looking at 59% of the industry was loss-making last year, just to put it in that perspective. So, Honourable Chairperson, if we look at a couple of the issues, and this is now on the next slide, which is slide number 18, there's a couple of issues that we'd like to focus on. Industry safety and performance has improved, but a lot more needs to be done.
Sorry, Mr. Burster. Okay. Can you repeat that other slide?
Sure.
Just the one before this. Can you repeat that slide? Especially the areas that deal with the structural changes in the industry. I don't really quite follow you in the shift to UG2 or.
Sure. Honourable Chairperson, I think what's important there is that we're just going through each of the different items. I think the falling platinum group metal demand and prices, we've illustrated in previous slides. On the escalating costs, I will provide more detail on it. For example, we've seen electricity prices escalating very rapidly. The structural changes are, if you go back a decade, the industry was mining more than 70% of the Morenci Reef, which has a platinum content of about 59% of the metal used, whereas UG2 ores have a platinum content of about 41%. So there's a lower platinum content per ton of ore that you mine, and so that's part of the structural changes that we've seen. So there's been a shift towards mining UG2 ores, and that's affected grade, and that's affected productivity. It's affected a number of things. It's not the only contributor to the fall off in productivity, but it's one of the contributing factors. Very important. So, Honourable Chairperson, I will get into a little bit of that detail in a moment, if you don't mind. So just a quick, if we look at the industry in crisis mode, the safety industry, the safety performance of the industry has improved, but we recognize a lot more needs to be done, and the industry obviously is very focused on it. You are aware of a lot of the significant tripartite initiatives that are going on that front. Demand and prices have fallen, input costs are rising, productivity has been falling, the strike and industrial activity has been affecting production, and despite a lot of lots being invested by the industry and community development, the industry is still perceived to be contributing to the communities and to the development of the country. So, you know, those are just a couple of the sort of headline type areas. If I could go into the detail of some of the issues, on the input cost side, and this is on slide number 19, what's interesting about this Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Committee members is that many of the costs that the industry is dealing with are costs that are not necessarily within the control of the mining companies. We've seen electricity prices have risen from a very low level of 18 cents per kilowatt in 2007 to 61 cents per kilowatt by 2012. This is a 238% increase. So in other words, the electricity price in the last 5 years tripled. For the platinum sector, that's added another 4 billion rands onto the cost profile of the industry within 5 years, just to highlight some of the cost pressure that we have faced over time. Diesel costs over the last 5 years increased by 15%, reinforcing steel prices by 15%, and remuneration in the sector has also risen on average by 12% per worker between 2007 and 2012. And that is shown in the slide on slide 20, where you can see electricity prices, for example, which comprise about 10% of cash production costs, have been rising at a very, very fast pace. And I'll get into a little bit more detail on electricity in a moment, but this is highlights many of the different cost drivers. On the electricity front, Honourable Chairperson, the industry has made a lot of effort in trying to reduce energy usage through putting in place energy efficiency technologies, by trying to shift demand to off-peak periods to obviously help reduce the stresses on the network, because obviously platinum is now the biggest demand driver for electricity in the mining sector, along with the gold mining sector. And we have seen in the platinum and gold sectors more than 500 megawatts of electricity being either saved or load shifted. A lot of the low-hanging fruit around energy efficiency is gone, because as you mine deeper, as you mine big areas, so the amount of electricity that you're using obviously incrementally increases. So it's a very big cost driver for us, and it's not for a lack of effort of the mining company, but it's a big issue for us. If I could just highlight the ESCOM increases, just to highlight through the committee members, and this is on slide number 21. What we've seen is the 238% increase in the period 2007 to 2012. ESCOM wants to double the price again by 2017. That will take electricity price somewhere up to the level of about around 28 per kilowatt. Honourable Chairperson and committee members, the platinum industry simply can't afford that rate of increase. It's just not possible, because it will just mean more of the industry is then placed into loss-making territory. And so it's just an area that we've very strongly lobbied in the hearings to NERSA, that South Africa's electricity price going up at that rate is unaffordable. We can talk about the reason for the increase, but we think that the increase could be much more reduced from current levels than what is being proposed by ESCOM. I'll just highlight there, to members of the committee, that if you look at ESCOM's pricing application just very quickly, 65% of the price increase being proposed by ESCOM is return on capital and depreciation charges. Only 12% of the increase is primary energy, which includes coal. So a lot of focus is being placed on coal costs. Coal is a very small part of the overall increase in the electricity pricing proposed by ESCOM. Most of the increase is return on capital and depreciation charges. Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, on slide 22, we're just highlighting here that in the last, in the period 2006 to 2011, in a five-year period, input costs of just four areas, I just focused very clearly on four areas, on stores and materials, on steel costs, on electricity costs, on labour costs, increased by some 28 billion between 2006 and 2011, and while production at the same time fell by some 6-7.8%. Now, a fall in production with higher costs means that your unit production costs obviously are rising at a faster pace. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen tremendous cost pressures on the industry over the course of the last 5 years. And again, to reiterate, on the electricity pricing side, costs have been going up, and there's, you can do as much as you can, but it doesn't overcome the pricing pressures that we've seen on the input cost side. Well, Chairperson, this demonstrates to you on slide number 26, sorry, the numbers are so small I can't see them at all. On slide number 23, that we look at the structural changes that have taken place in the industry. This just gives you an idea. So in the early 2000s, we were mining more than 70% Morantzy ores. Today we're mining more than 70% UG2 ores. and that shows you the structural shock. Platinum, as a percent of the total metals that are recovered from Moravsky ore, by 59%, platinum is 59%, whereas in UG2 ore it's 41%, as an example. So it just highlights that getting less per ton of ore that you mine, and that's been one of the structural changes we have seen. On slide number 24, Honourable Deputy, this is just great, and I just want to highlight, productivity is not just about output per worker. Productivity is measured in terms of capital productivity, technology productivity, management productivity, and it's a multifaceted view of the productivity equation. But we just wanted to highlight in this particular slide that we've had declining productivity, and declining productivity is a function of a number of issues, including structural changes in the industry, and the amount of ships that we're mining on a calendar basis, but also that costs per unit of output have also obviously also been rising at a very quick pace. And that's demonstrated in slide number 24 of the chart. So Honourable Chairperson and members of the committee, if we go to slide 25, what we've then done is this is basically a cost and maintenance capital equation for 2012 on average. You'll see that I've got an arrow pointing which shows the companies that are then loss-making above the price line was then received. But it shows that a significant portion of the industry was then in a loss-making position. In other words, not covering their sustaining capital costs from existing prices. And that obviously has big implications for the industry because companies have had to go back into the capital market to try and borrow money for long-term projects, or projects that would be bringing platinum on in 5 or 10 years' time, while in the short term, really being faced with challenges around the viability of a number of shops and a number of mines. And this obviously has significant consequences. It's not just one company that's facing the challenges, it's many of the companies are in the same boat, facing a set of these costing and pricing challenges which place them to unviable territory. And I guess one of the questions that one needs to deliberate on is this idea that we've got to do everything that we can to obviously try and minimize job losses and the structure in the most pragmatic and sensible way. But at the same time, we've got to make sure that the industry is ultimately viable for the longer term, because the benefits in the longer term are obviously also very important. We don't want prejudice and risk at the same time in the industry in the short term. We want to be a viable, prosperous, employing industry going forward, and that will be one of the challenges. In the short term, the industry has obviously been very challenged by price and cost-related challenges. So if we go on to slide number 26, the illegal strikes in 2012 unfortunately did exacerbate the situation. And obviously, the Marijuana tragedy and the lives, 50 lives that are lost, had a big impact on the reputation of South Africa as a key mining investment destination, obviously on South Africa's platinum group metal mining sector, the world's preeminent platinum mining sector. The price and due decline in production also exacerbated a bit of the cost squeeze that the industry was facing, as there was less production covering the cost structure of the industry. About 10 billion revenue was lost as a result of the strike activity, and that excludes the losses related to businesses that suppliers, for example, that would be providing goods and services to the mining industry, to the platinum sector, that were also standing still during strike activity, the taxes that have been forfeited, etc. So there were very big impacts. The 10 billion is just a revenue calculation. We could probably double that number in relation to the overall impact on the sector. And obviously, further strike action in 2013 could further undermine the platinum sector. So, you know, obviously 2013 is a wage negotiating year, and, you know, it is a very important year for the sector in terms of getting through the wage discussions and all parties playing their role as effectively as possible in working through the challenges we face. Honourable Chairperson, then going into the last section of the presentation, and this is taking a strategic country's perspective of the platinum industry. Platinum is a critically important industry. I think we've demonstrated that, and I think we have a shared view that it is a critically important component of the sector. On slide number 28, we just want to highlight that there is a task team that was established under the Mining Industry Growth Development and Employment Task Team, what we call MIGDEF, the MIGDEF process. This task team was established by the Department of Mineral Resources, in partnership with the Chamber of Mines, other organized business and organized labor. For example, Gideon Tlisi from Solidarity participates in MIGDEF. A declaration was developed within the MIGDEF Platinum Task Team process. And the focus was on short-term issues and long-term issues. If I could just say on short-term issues, obviously you've got the loss-making operations and the viability challenges that certain of the loss-making operations facing. Collectively working on trying to help the industry through the crisis. I think this has been a very big focal point of the stakeholders in the Mid-Mid Platinum Task Team. Looking at how one can reduce the cost pressures while minimizing job losses as much as possible, and obviously also looking at mitigation plans in the event of job losses, where ultimately inevitably restructuring requires a certain level of downscaling to take place. So that's on the short-term issues. If I can go to the next slide, which is slide 29, and look at the Platinum Task Team long-term issues, repositioning the industry for growth. And so some of the issues we've been discussing in that Task Team have been looking at taking a strategic approach to the platinum mining industry. It is an important industry for the country, looking at how we can restore investment confidence in the sector, reducing costs where possible and improving productivity, collaborating on expanding demand, which is obviously good for the country, being able to sell into an expanding global market, and expanding the potential of the mining sector. This is through constraining costs and enhancing our capability to meet growing demand in the future. So that's a quick snapshot of what's happened in the Platinum Task Team without going into the detail of it. But if you look at a way forward, which is on slide number 30, it is the penultimate slide. If we look at a way forward for the sector, South Africa is a critically important component of the global platinum group metal supply chain, given our resource endowment in platinum. But it's critically important that we stabilize our production cycles and reposition the industry for growth in medium to longer term by focusing on competitiveness. All stakeholders have a role to play in contributing to that, and we certainly think that at a parliament level, you also have a very important role to play, hence the timely nature of this particular meeting, or long overdue nature of this particular meeting. In terms of, if we look at community development as an example, all tiers of government, the mining companies, the communities, organized labor, and parliament has a role to play in helping to help us and everyone meet the challenges in this area, because if any one of those cogs doesn't work efficiently and effectively, it affects everything else. And I think maybe it's an area that we need to look at. It is critically important to restore investor confidence in the sector, create a stable environment to promote investment. EPG and mining, I think the sector has been rattled by the developments over the last 18 months, and I think we've all been rattled by the developments, not just the sector itself, it's affected South Africa as a whole. We think that promoting beneficiation and research and development are critically important angles, and I think the platinum sector is playing its role there. 13% of the world's platinum pellet converters, for example, are fabricated in South Africa last year. And I think most importantly, these goals are best achieved through collaborative efforts with all stakeholders, agreeing on what the challenges are and obviously working toward them. So, I mean, if I can give you one example, through this labor turmoil, the criticality of getting the different parties to come together and engage in a collaborative fashion and look and work through solutions is a role that certainly the Portfolio Committee could play, as well as oversight role as an example. So, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Committee, in conclusion, the industry is in crisis, the platinum group metal sector is in crisis, and South Africa is facing a crisis as a result of this industry being in crisis. But platinum still very much matters. Platinum mining matters for the growth, development, and transformation of the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any additions from your side? Not. Okay. Yeah, let's thank the Chamber of Mines for the elaborate presentation that you have given us. Surely there are questions that arise. But what I like is that also you've included in your slides an input on the way forward, which is what we would also spend some time on to look at what then needs to be done. But honorable member, there you have the presentation. Before I take it on myself, let's ask questions for clarity. Let's engage with the presentation as it has been presented to us by the Chamber of Mines on behalf of the Platinum Group Mining Company. Any takers? Honorable Lorimer? Honorable Wang? Honorable Schmidt? Honorable Sondo? Honorable Vigani, Honorable Polus.
Chair, two things are going to be happening are going to be very prominent in mining this year. One is the discussion on adjustments to mining royalties taxes that was hinted at by the President in his State of the Nation speech. The other one is the passage of the NPRDA Amendment Bill. I'd like to know what your opinion is of the impact of each of these on the platinum sector. Secondly, I'd like to know a bit more about MIGZET. We know that it's going on. We don't hear much about what actually happens there. What concrete achievements have taken place in MIGZET to help alleviate this crisis?
Let me start with correct one thing, Honorable Lorimer. We hear about the MPRDA amendment. We have not seen it as yet. It is still a process between the department and its stakeholders. So, Chamber, you can give your overall view, not the details, because you will be talking above our heads. Those amendments have not yet been tabled here in Parliament. They are still a matter between yourselves and the department. So until you have seen how do they look like, what is the final product that emerges out of this process, then we can speak authoritatively over them. So when you respond, don't bore us with the detail of section this and that and all of that. Give a general view to the question asked by the Honourable Member so that we are on par on that matter. Honourable Wang.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. Taking a look at the ESCOM proposed trajectory, over these past few years, you said from 2007 to 2012, it's increased by 238%. And in the next few years, it's going to increase to 580%, 87% in the next 11 years. For these, what is the mining company? Are they taking a look at green energy? For South Africa, a few years ago, we had the COP17, so to promote green energy in the field. And I'd assume that with mining and also the increase in ESCOM prices, that the mining companies and the whole mining industry will actually take a look at going in a more green energy or green energy environment. That's question one. You said that the mining, there's been structural changes in the mining industry. You said that there's a lower production per ton because there was the marine fuel, you changed back to the water, and there's been changed to UG2 ore. For this, over these past years, there should be better technology of mining. I know that with, for example, the recycling, with the dumps, they produce a higher ton because of the technology improving. How is that technology actually improving and is it up to par? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question basically relates to the projections forward for the economic cycle of platinum in particular. The international demand and supply cycle is something we don't have control of. But within that cycle, we have other cycles. Let's say iron ore, or the gold, or the platinum, or the palladium. Now, I'm very concerned about one particular slide. That's the slide concerning the growth in terms of demand and those prices for iron ore, copper, and those kind of issues. Mm-hmm. But it is not happening in terms of platinum. Mm-hmm. So there's, in my view, a structural problem with platinum, because If it's true with regards to those minerals indicated in that slide, I don't have a slide number, why is it not true with regards to platinum? Now, the possible answer to that would be substitution by palladium. If it's substitution by palladium, it's a problem, because platinum's, the bottom of the I can't put it better, the underlying basis of demand for platinum is going to go. Because of reducing prices, supply will ultimately be affected, I say it will have to be affected, with the consequence of the social, political impact or economic impact. My concern is, and I've heard Peter Carroll saying, we need to develop alternatives. We need to focus on research and development. We need to get a different use, I could put it that way, more easily said, for platinum. Is that a fair summation? Am I being overly concerned? Or is it just a cycle which, in your view, with all economic data, one which might take a bit longer to recover because of the inherent cost of platinum or the inherent demand of platinum? But then we're back to the basic substitution issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chamber, for the presentation. I was looking at your heading, speaking against your way forward, you must fly. Your wording is talking, your heading is talking about crisis in the mining sector. Once you look at that heading, you lower your head, but when you look at your last slide, you make a distinction that yes, there is a crisis, yet that crisis is not catastrophic. It has not reached that catastrophic level. Is that the case? I take it when you are saying if stakeholders can come to the party, at least some mining place in the gold platinum sector could be saved. Is that what you are telling us? That is one separate thing. The second one would be only, more needs to come to the fore, the structural changes in the mining industry, because as it stands now, as you are projecting it there, it's open to various interpretations. The background of mining in general is such that profit was just taken away. Are these structural shifts now, or structural changes, as a result of some demand that there should be an input in community, more wages, and all that? Are we talking that language in this instance? And it takes me to what you refer to as a perception. You are saying it is perceived that this mining sector's contribution to community development is too little. Why would you say that? Why would you say it's perception? Because what you are saying that mining communities are not factual when they are saying community development and other inputs by mining companies in their community, their livelihood is minimal if it is not nil. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Bilani.
Thank you, Jim. Also appreciating the presentation, I'd like to go to slide 40. Roger made mention of community investment that excludes housing. Was I correct to hear that? Can you just expatiate on that, just to give an indication of what the issue is in relation to possibly including that, including housing as an investment? And the other issue is, if you look at slide 17, where you're talking about your crisis in the mining industry, the reasons, I'd like to go in particular to the illegal strike action as an issue. To ask a direct answer, Chair, in relation to how have the underlying causes been handled, and how have they been prioritized to ensure that there's a turnaround strategy or solution in ensuring that there's actually improvement in laborers going back to work and actually improving production. And more so, out of these underlying causes, what is the relationship being with the Department of Labor in particular to ensure that where there's grey areas in terms of their grievances, how best have you then been handling issues around that? And I think rather than just coming up with options of saying that this has to be refreshed, surely something could be looked at in trying to have a review or a turnaround strategy to ensure that other solutions can be sought. When coming to the mining industry growth, development and employment task team, I think earlier on colleague has already mentioned that we're not hearing much about MICDET. But what I'd like to know is, what is the lifespan of the task team? And how often would they sit as MICDET? And furthermore, your relationship as MICDET and running your program related to the mining Lekgotla, for example, where you find that the mining Lekgotla actually consists of mainly the chamber, the MUM, and the department, DMR. Where then do we see the MICDET part of it featuring to give that impression that it's a unified structure that is working together, because it does give a sense that there could be some split in the way you are doing your work, and which could be resulting in the fact that you are actually not meeting your target in relation to what should be happening as MICDET. And then in mentioning your way forward, I hear what you're saying in terms of the way forward, but how best are you then ensuring that there would be improved investment, especially in relation to perhaps as a solution looking at industrialization within the country or production within the country, as a way forward of paying that as part of your claim, and what would be the challenges in relation to that then? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also add my voice and thank the presentation from Roger, who is a member of mine. I think I like your way forward, especially where you say that it brings a critical need to restore investor confidence in the sector and create a stable environment to promote investment in the economic sector and promoting beneficiation and research and development. I think it's a beautiful way forward. But I just have some concerns actually here. I just want you to assure this committee on your long-term plan with regard to platinum mining. It would be interesting actually to know if you are not going to do the same as what the DS did. You know, they left the country. Are you assuring us here that the industry in platinum actually is going to stay in the country? I just need this assurance. And then, of course, the second one would be on the... I just wanted to check our current standing as a country. I know that you were always number one in the platinum production. Where do we stand currently as a country? Just need that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Would you care to respond to those for now? We'll come on the second round.
Chairman, thank you very much, and the honourable members of the committee, thank you very much for the very insightful questions, which I'm going to also ask some of my colleagues to also supplement if they want to, but if you don't mind me having a third pass at trying to answer the detail of each question, because they are all critically important issues. Honourable member Lorimer asked the question on the taxes and royalty discussion. I think what's really important from an impact point of view is that I think the ANC very clearly articulated the need for an equitable sharing of the rent, but that government will engage with the industry in a way that is non-disruptive to the industry and which promotes the balance between the interests of the country and the interests of the industry to be competitive. So I think it's a very strong commitment to promoting stability around the taxation translation for mining. Obviously, the taxation review at the end of the year, in the second half of the year, is certainly going to be very important for the sector. I guess to have a critical point on that, and that's what I'm trying to lobby or influence that issue. If I show the slide of the project lifespan of a mineral project, you're looking at maybe 5 to 10 years for exploring to find the project. You're looking at probably 5 to 10 years to do the feasibilities and to do something bankable to start developing a project. It will take you, in the platinum sector, anywhere between 10 and 20 years to actually develop the project or mining. Let's say 10 years. And then you'll have a mining life of maybe 20 to 30 years, depending on what the nature of the project is itself. And you have the closure period. If you look at that sort of 30-year period, the industry is only can be profitable during the production cycle. For any other component is a net cash outflow. So it's quite important to look at the industry in overall product, on its overall life cycle, mining life cycle, as opposed to, I think often we get fixated with a particular point in, you know, in the industry's life, when the industry is, you know, when the industry is doing well, and we've got to look at it more on a sort of holistic basis. So just a thought on that, but I think the ANC handled it exceptionally well in terms of, it's going to be a process and we're going to engage in it collectively later in the year. Honourable Chairman, you asked me not to be too specific on the MPLA Amendment Bill. Just to say that from the Chamber side, we're obviously looking forward to engaging with the Portfolio Committee and the DMR, you know, on some of the issues within the Amendment Bill. Clearly, the Minister has given a firm commitment to addressing a number of issues in the Amendment Bill, including around providing more guidance on discretion, helping to facilitate better environmental authorisation, et cetera, and to promote appreciation. So I think at this stage, without passing too much comment, it's going to be discussed in a lot of depth, I think, as the committee. You know, it's a draft is on the table, and obviously that's being looked at and engaged on. If I could just then touch on the concrete achievements within MIGDA itself.
I think part of the question was on the question of access. Your principal take on the proposals that are doing the round in terms of the adjustments that are imposed on the royalties, what would be your attitude towards that, given the fact that it has been established even by the committee that we are not sharing enough when it comes to the mineral world in this country? Especially when we do oversight, we would go through abject poverty within, you know, the close proximity of the mining operations. And indeed, of course, on the other hand, you are paying wages to people who are working in the mining industry. And indeed, making some contributions through your corporate social responsibilities in some of the areas. But now, what we want to gauge from you is your attitude towards this proposal. Are you, in principle, in favor of engaging on the need for the royalties to be amended as it is acknowledged?
Honourable Chairman, I think the way that we're looking at it is that without defending the status quo, we're looking forward to engaging on the subject of the equitable sharing of the rents. So I think it doesn't necessarily preclude or include changes in the tax side. It's kind of like looking at what the contribution is, and it's multifaceted. I guess I can just, you know, use an example. If you look at the sector as a whole, at a corporate tax level, mining is contributing, in 2011, contributed 25.8 billion in tax directly and 5.5 billion in royalties. The corporate taxes alone accounted for 17.2% of total corporate taxes paid, despite the fact that mining is only 9% of GDP. So, you know, that's one example. There obviously is different profitability within different components of the mining sector. In iron ore mining, there's a different level of profitability compared to the platinum sector, which is really struggling at the moment. So we're really looking forward to engaging on the challenges. I also just say, from a There obviously is a social tax contribution point of view, but there's also a very strong commitment that the state has made. For example, in 2011, on the skills front, the industry spent 4 billion rand over and above the 1% levy, skills levy, on education and training, as an example. It's a very strong commitment to recognizing that we are very much part of South Africa and want to make a positive contribution going forward. So, Honourable Jefferson, we're looking forward to that discussion.
Honourable Chair, just to add to what my colleague said, I'll defer to him on the detail. But I think we speak a lot about sharing, which is very important, but not often do we speak about create. And I think this is the bigger conversation. So we need to talk about creating the value. How does that happen? And so these deliberations that we're having around taxes and the like, are those, how do they impact on the creative part? And I think that's very important also just to put on the table.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. The outcry from communities is that they do not see enough, I think, what was the refers to that. Mr. Bakar is just giving an example that since the institution of the royalty tax 2009, as of 2011, 5.5 billion rand was paid towards national treasury. The challenge the mining industry has is that over and above that it's got social and labor plans, which they are making their hard effort to make sure that they work. However, the challenge that the country has, in my view, is that we take that money and put it into the fiscal kitty. And it gets absorbed in all the challenges that the country is having. And the mining industry is making a contribution. And is the debate perhaps not what are we going to do with this royalty to actually create that impression, to change the negative impression to positive impression that the money that is coming from the mining sector is indeed being used to benefit some of the communities who are crying out there for royalties. Because they don't see the royalties up, but they get absorbed into all the challenges that the country is facing. But I think that's the debate that the country needs to engage in. And let's see how we take it forward and see whether we can't, I don't want to say make an impact, to see whether we can't make a difference, especially in those communities that are crying foul because the mining sector is actually not paying royalties. Thank you, Chair.
You see, the mineral wealth is the national heritage of all South Africans. Once we begin to talk about ring fencing, the revenue generated from the mining industry for the mining industry's use, then we're missing the point altogether. I think we need to think more lateral than that. And in as far as the question on the generating of the cake is concerned, is that mining has been there for more than a century in this country. It has been generating profits, but the profits have been used, skewed all these years. There's been no plow back by the mining industry into the development of the country per se, particularly when it comes to social responsibilities. And that's a proven point. We don't have to go back to that. It's there. And even as we speak now, productivity levels are still at an acceptable level, given all the challenges in terms of illegal strikes and all of that. This is a recent situation. Otherwise, in the past, there's been stability. I think we would like to remain with what Mr. Baxter has raised, that you are open to engagement so that we engage on the sharing or redistributive nature of the wealth generated from the mineral
from the minerals of the country. What form and nature will that take is a matter that we need to further envision. Okay, go on.
Chairman, Honourable Chairman, thank you very much. On the question of the concrete treatment in Big Death, I think first of all, Big Death was set up in 2008, December 2008, just when the global financial crisis was hitting, and there were very strong efforts in the short term to try and prevent, to try and help slow down the rate of increases in job losses at that time. And there was a lot of work done around the review of the mining charter in one track and looking at the competitiveness of the sector and developing a declaration as well as a growth strategy for the sector. So the bigger MIGDET process actually has been a very constructive tripartite process of engagement between labor, business and government. And I certainly think that it played a very important role in getting mining back on the priority list of government. And that's not reflected, obviously, in the National Development Plan, New Growth Path, the National Policy Action Plan, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the MIGDET itself. If you look at the MIGDET platinum task team specifically, that was set only in June last year. There were a large number of meetings, and obviously the crisis then hit the industry, the strike, legal strike crisis, and obviously I think everyone was then focused on trying to help stabilize the situation. So there was a little bit of a hiatus in the process. But a lot of work was done developing a document, looking at what the challenges facing the sector, et cetera. And so I think a lot of constructive engagement has taken place in it. Just to highlight the process. And it has been, it is working in 2013 with a lot of work taking place. We're certainly spending a lot of time in it as the stakeholders in the platinum industry. If I can move on.
I hear you mentioning that the MIGDET platinum now. Is it the same stakeholders that are involved in the overall MIGDET? And what is the reason separating it from the rest?
You've got the overall plenary MIGDET, which is the overarching structure, which is ultimately chaired by the minister. And you've got the MIGDET as a task, the platinum task team as a task team of MIGDET. So it's leads in the MIGDET itself. Honourable Member Wang asked the question around technology. If I can just highlight, one area that on the platinum side we just to focus on, one of the companies, Anglo Platinum, put in conjunction with the technology service provider, developed a fuel cell which has been running in Mhalaleni, I can't pronounce it properly, but I'll get there one day, producing about 20 kilowatts of power. And in Mhalaleni, I'll get there. My economy is not getting there, but I'll get there in due course. But what's interesting is that's an example of, can South Africa be the frontier in which we showed the rest of the world that fuel cell technology is a viable technology that can be used at the global level. I mean, I just use that as an example. And so our mining companies in the platinum sector looking at green technologies, one of the challenges we have is that deep level mines have very high ambient rock temperatures underground, and it's critically important to have base load stable electricity. So you can't use wind power as an example because the power is available 20% of the time, and you don't want workers sitting underground. I'm just using it if you're right on the base level. So the industry spends a lot of money looking at technologies that improve the efficiency of the existing electricity usage where possible. But there are some of these exciting new technologies that over time may become quite useful. I mean, I think maybe one day in the future, if we think 10 years ahead or hopefully 5 years ahead, all of us might be driving a fuel cell driven car, obviously made of platinum, Chairman, which you can then plug into the wall at home and which helps power your house, as an example. You know, maybe we need to think like that as a country about future technologies.
If I may just add to that, I think Roger's mentioned some of the beneficiation projects, particularly around power generation that Anglo Platinum and a number of the other platinum companies have also been involved with. And for many years now, our main focus around fuel cells has been as a substitute for vehicle fuel cells. And I think we've spent now a number of years, but as we keep doing that development, so you get other forms of energy that are coming on board in the US, for example, shale gas. And then at the same time, the energy efficiency of the vehicles is becoming more efficient every single year. And so we keep competing against the target that's getting more difficult to catch. And I think we've realized that fuel cells for motor vehicles is probably the wrong technology to be pursuing as a real big solution. And so for the last few years, we've been focusing more on stationary fuel cells.
And we really do think that that has got much more benefit. Of course, it's got more benefit in terms of our power solutions for the future. We're looking very seriously, for example, at fuel cells for telecommunication towers, because all of those have to have backup power generators, and they're all diesel generators as we speak. So we think there's some really good solutions there. We also think there's some really good solutions around deep rural areas that don't have grid electrification. In those areas, where you add the cost of the grid to the generation of power, actually some really good potential, we think, for platinum fuel cells. So it has beneficiation potential in South Africa, but it also has very real potential, but not in the short term, has potential to sort of offset some of the power demands for the country. There's some exciting work happening. Most platinum companies in some way or another have programs for stationary fuel cells, and I certainly see for Anglo-American Platinum that we have a number of very big projects. We're talking to Ballard from Canada, and with saying when we develop these things, we develop things like that. That's just an addition to what Roger did, Chair. Thank you.
Just the second question there, I don't know about Mel Wang, was also on the structural changes in sector and technology. So just if we look at the technology side, I mean, obviously the industry has technology in mining tends to be more incremental improvements, not sort of quantum leap. And, you know, so South Africa's technology frontier on the mining side encompasses very capital intensive and also labor intensive type mining, rice future very capital intensive type mining. We see it very much as an evolutionary process. I think there's strong recognition that as we go forward, the mine of the future is one where you have more skilled workers, obviously maybe some less skilled, you know, less herbal numbers of workers, but which contribute to a sector from a more capital-intensive, technology-intensive type sector. But that's the mine of the future that I think as we work forward, you know, making sure that our education, schools, etc., are producing the types of people who help the country and help the sector at the same time. But you know, that's an incremental process over time. If I could answer Honourable Member Schmidt's questions around projections going forward. Obviously, the one area is that Europe is a big market for platinum. And Europe is in recession now. The expectation is that Europe will start recovering, but it's going to remain very weak for a couple of years. It's not expected to grow sort of 3-4% this year and 3-4% next year. If they achieve a 0.5% growth rate this year, you know, they would have done a lot compared to a 0.5% negative decline last year. So I think the next couple of years, demand in Europe is going to remain weak, which is a key market for platinum. There have been some changes in the structure of the platinum market over time. So you have a bit of thrifting, you have a bit of substitution taking place away from platinum and rhodium towards palladium. You've also got you know, the expanding new uses, whether it's fuel cells, but also expanding new markets like China. Which over time, as it raises its emission standards, North America, as it raises its emission standards, North America, as it becomes a little bit more enticed by diesel-powered vehicles away from the traditional petrol-powered vehicles, have opportunities. But those opportunities are medium long-term, they're not short-term. You know, so I think it's critically important to say in the short-term, next year or two, it's likely that we're going to be in still very difficult space as a platinum industry.
Chase, I may just add to that as well. The reason that we have today is because the platinum industry is in a crisis. Roger mentioned that about 50% of, at last year's metal price, about 50% of the industry was loss-making. I speak for our own company, we made 1.5 billion rand loss, and if you look at an operating profit level, it was 6 billion rand loss. This is an industry in crisis. If you have a look at all the major companies, have had to go back to their shareholders in the last 3 years. Anglo-American went back to, Platinum went back to its shareholders in beginning of 2010. We asked for 12.5 billion rand to be put back into this industry. The shareholders in Platinum have actually been putting money into the industry, not taking money out of the industry for many years now. And you know, so I think it's very important that we do realize that this is an industry crisis. I think Roger mentioned that for the next couple of years, this is likely to be the case. I think it's important that we just reflect quickly on those four key structural changes that have changed the business. This is not just a cyclical change we have seen, and we think that this is going to be an industry that is going to be very, very, very difficult for the next couple of years. If you have a look, I mean, we've mentioned the cost issue. The costs are rising probably about twice the pace of inflation in the mining industry. So if inflation is 5-6%, mining inflation is probably at about 10%. And we have additional costs that are actually driving that number up, not down. I mean, we've spoken about the electricity. Electricity, Roger mentioned, I'll just give you one fact. I mean, Roger mentioned in the last 5 years, electricity probably added about $4 billion extra. Just for Anglo Platinum, that number was $2 billion. In the next 5 years, with the current tariff, I mean, everyone's speaking about a tariff of 16%. For mining companies, they want a tariff of 21%. The number for Anglo Platinum just for the next 5 years will be an additional 3 billion rand to the cost. So the cost issue is a very real issue. Then we've spoken, Roger spoke about supply and demand. Demand has been flat. It's actually been decreasing. And Roger's already spoken about the difficulties in Europe. So Europe is unlikely to turn around in the short term. AutoCap, the demand out of AutoCap has been going down in the last 5 years by almost 9% per annum. Luckily, we had an increase in jewelry. All the work that was done to promote jewelry in the last 2 years in China has actually made up that amount, just to keep it flat. So we haven't seen the increase we anticipated, because jewelry demand is coming, because AutoCap demand has been coming down by 9% per annum for the last 5 years. Luckily, as I said, jewelry is compensating for that. So demand has been flat. But at the same time demand has been flat, Roger mentioned that supply from mining companies is increasing slightly. But from secondary supply, you know, 8-9 years ago was 500,000 ounces. Roger mentioned it's almost 2 million ounces now. So it's quadrupled over that period. So we're seeing demand flat. We're seeing supply is now exceeding demand very substantially. Last year, 1 million ounces was lost in the overall platinum industry, about 800,000 from strikes, and around 200,000 ounces because the price wasn't high enough, and for some of the secondary supply that would have came, that will come back when the price lifts. And Roger mentioned last year only about 400,000 ounces of the deficit was taken out, but we lost 1 million. So there's 600 there that in a normal year would have just been on top of that. And so that shows that the industry is in oversupply. So we have these costs rising, demand back, supply exceeding demand, meaning that the price is unlikely to rise. And in that same environment, we've got some other fundamentals happening. We're switching away from platinum and from rhodium into palladium, and they're also using less of it in each of the items they use. And that means that is why the industry is facing all the difficulty that it is at the moment. And then there was a number of other things that were mentioned. But I think that it is important. So the point that you raised and the concern you raised is saying, is this as bad as it sounds? It is that bad. And I think we need to, you know, we can fight with each other and we can say, well, you must surely be messing something up, or, you know, you can't be right. And it's not only as a result of the strikes at the end of last year, but the strikes at the end of last year added a very big problem to an already big problem. And that's why I think when Roger says that actually this is something that we all have in some way something to contribute to, I think he's exactly right. We've all got to be urging our, and certainly the meeting we had yesterday, Chairman, with Labour and Minister, we think we reached a new level of understanding with Labour to work together. So Labour to work together, the companies and Labour to work together so that we can be as productive as possible. Let's make sure the costs that we're adding to industry, we keep them down as much as possible. And then all of us be promoting South Africa, at least people still want to put their money in here. I'll give you just one final example, Chair, before I keep quiet for a while. We had this Labour incident at one of our mines in the week. In one session of the mockers, we lost 5% of the share price of the company. So people are looking at this stuff and saying, I don't want to be in this industry. I don't want to put my money into this industry. And as we are battling to keep money for investment, we try to invest in this company and invest in this industry, because all of us have investment plans. I mean, for example, we spent about 9 billion rand on average for the last 10 years, every year. And we continue to have those plans going forward. we'd have to go and ask our shareholders to put that money into the company because we want to grow and we want to stay in South Africa. But that kind of environment, if we keep having all these stoppages, we keep having all these difficulties, and we keep sending these difficult messages from South Africa, from the platinum companies, we're going to find it very difficult to ask for that money that we want to put into maintaining our presence here in South Africa. I think just as an addition there, just to help set the scene that we actually are in a lot of trouble with the platinum companies now. Thank you, Shane. Thank you.
We understand that on the input cost, your major problem revolves around energy. The logical question would be, have you met Eskom? What were your discussions with Eskom? Within that equation, what role does the price of coal play in terms of Eskom's input for them to generate energy? And that, the last I heard was that somebody such as BHP Billiton had a special arrangement with Eskom, which actually raised eyebrows when it comes to communities, because they felt that, the domestic consumers are basically subsidizing, the major companies. Now, if you can unpack that for us, whether you have met with Eskom, if your discussions are along the same lines as the agreement between Eskom and BHP Billiton is, or if it's something else that you're talking about, and what is the role of the coal price in the whole arrangement?
Honourable Chairperson, thank you. If we look at the various cost drivers in platinum mining, energy is an important part, but not the only part. If we just look at other areas like fuel prices, diesel costs, labor costs, etc., these have also been adding quite significantly to cost pressures over the course of the last 5 years. So if we look at the platinum mine cash costs per 4E ounce over the last 5 years have been going up by 18% per year underneath the rate of increase in electricity price, but clearly an unsustainable rate of price increase. On the energy side, Honourable Chairman, just to say to you that coal in the next, if you look at the 5 year period that Eskom are predicting their electricity prices, and I'll go back into our discussions with Eskom on the issue, is that in the next 5 years, coal goes from being 27% of the electricity price to 21% of the electricity price over 5 years. Coal is not the problem, Honourable Chairman. Eskom's sole drive to achieve an investment, standalone investment grade rating is being done at the expense of the whole country. As I mentioned earlier, 65% of the price increase, 65%, two-thirds of the price increase in the next 5 years is return capital, profit, and depreciation. Very happy to show a slide. I can pick up very quickly in terms of what the cost profile is. Very happy to share with you a copy of our presentation to Minister on the matter. Primary energy makes up only 12% of the overall increase in that five-year period, but as a share of the total costs, coal itself actually declines over a period because it's not coal that's driving the cost increase, it's the return on capital and depreciation charges that Eskom is looking for. So it's very important to specify that that's the big challenge. A lot of song and dance is being made about coal being the key driver, and I'm afraid to say that's not the issue. It's a contributing factor, but it's not the primary driver of where electricity prices are going in terms of Eskom's pricing application. We have, from the industry side, been very effective, very intricately engaged with NERSA, obviously, at the hearings to provide our inputs at that level, because also the regulator needs to make the decisions around electricity prices. We also have been engaged with Eskom on issues like coal and others, but there is a recognition that pricing increases of this magnitude are simply not affordable because the industry is at a tipping point. It will just push more of the industry into the red, and that's not something which is good for the platinum sector or for the, or for the country as a whole. So that's on the cost front. I mean, on other costs, obviously we've seen things like diesel prices going up, but diesel is a very small component of platinum mining costs. Diesel is a bit of surface mining platinum that does take that, but most of it is underground and depends on electricity. So electricity is the primary energy driver, as an example. In terms of...
Honourable
Chair, I just wanted to say that, add on to what Chris said, our own experience in London is consistent with what he raised. I mean, in the fourth quarter of last year, we had to raise $800 million, even more than that, in a rights issue.
an emergency rights issue. And, you know, this is symptomatic of the type of issues we have in our industry. And to speak to some of the issues that one of the honorable members raised is about the way forward, acknowledging that we're in crisis. I think, you know, it's not a crisis that started. We have been in crisis. But the important thing is really to say that that is required to be the collaborative stakeholder response. And I think we are okay with all of this. But a lot of the chances that we have in honest conversation about the economic and social realities, not just, you know, what have the mining companies done lately. That is just the point I just wanted to put on the table, because we are, this is a reality for us. This is a real reality.
Thanks, Honorable Sir. I just want to add to what Chris says as well, because I don't want it to sound like an Anglo Platinum problem, because of course they've announced their issues and they've put forward some thoughts of what it might do. It's not just an Anglo Platinum problem. If I can speak for Impala Platinum, we are facing exactly the same issues. We've got three large shafts that we're currently sinking that will come into production in the next 5 years. We've got six shafts that are the end of the life that will end. Basically, as we speak right now, what has happened at Impala is our costs have doubled in the last 5 years. The big driver has been labor costs and electricity. Our income has stayed the same. So our profit margin has completely been eroded. As we speak now, we're in a loss-making, at least we're breaking even. We are not paying taxes because we're not making profits. Right now, we are not making profits, so we're not paying taxes. To ensure that we sustain these shaft projects so that we can place our employees when the other shafts close down in the next couple of years and that we don't have to go through a retrenchment. And remember, these three shafts will make up 50% of our future production. We have to go back to our shareholders this week and ask for $500 million just so that we, in a loss-making situation, can carry on sinking these shafts to preserve jobs. Mm. So in terms of the shareholders and the returns in this last couple of years, it's been very limited because we haven't been making profits. In terms of saving the industry, I think we have to acknowledge that they've contributed by putting money back into these organizations. And I think what we are doing at MICTED is also important, because what we're saying there is, as the other stakeholders, what is it that we can do to also make sure that we take it forward? So I want the committee to just understand, as much as Anglo has put some ideas forward that might impact on jobs, it's not an Anglo issue, it's an industry issue.
Okay. Okay, Chairman. So I think Honourable Member, some of the questions have been answered in relation to are we in a crisis? Yes, very much so. Is it catastrophic? Well, it's certainly very, very challenging and likely to be so for the next 2 years. And that we have to work collaboratively, and you know, structures like MICTED are critically important for allowing that collaborative interaction and these types of interactions with Parliament are critically important to taking things forward. Are the structural changes as a result of high demands on the industry? No, I think the structural changes are much more related to global markets and to local mining conditions than anything else. And the platinum sector is very much firmly part of trying to make a tangible difference in the labor communities, in the areas in which we operate. But at the same time, obviously, trying to have viable businesses. On the community investment side, are we investing a little bit in this? Is it positional reality? I think there is a bit of a mixed picture that emerges for both. What I would say to you, though, is that the industry has not got a lot of credit for some of the very good work that it's done on housing, for example. But we want to recognize that there are gaps. But there are gaps where if you don't have collaboration from local governments, if you don't have collaboration from other stakeholders, it does get you gaps. So I think what's happened, the events of the last 18 months, have really helped focus the minds of parts of human settlements, of parts of mineral resources, of local government, provincial government, the companies, local communities, on how to do things more effectively to help develop the tangible outcome that we want in communities. So I think that's really the point that we wanted to make on that.
Sorry, Roger, can I add to that?
Sure, please.
Sorry, Chair, I think it's an important point. And again, I can only really speak about Impala Platinum, but I'm sure the other company can contribute. In the last 5 years, when we've been going, since the economic crisis, since we've been going into this challenging environment, Impala Platinum has spent more than 2 billion rand on community projects. On the bulk of it on housing. We've converted all of our hostels in line with our social and labour plan. We started significant housing projects for our employees. We've invested in community support like schools in these housing areas. So in an environment where our profit margins have been squeezed and we've gone into a non-tax-paying environment, we haven't reduced our spend in terms of community and housing. In fact, we increased it because of the social need. The one thing that we cannot control is the poverty that we see out there and the lack of jobs. Our mines in Rustenburg are sizable. There's about 50,000 people that work in our Rustenburg mine. So in terms of jobs, what we are seeing is people are flooding from deep rural areas to come and establish themselves around these mines to secure a chance of getting a job. And it's bringing all sorts of social problems. So in terms of trying to resolve some of these issues, we are working with all the stakeholders, not just to assist our own employees who live around the mines and make sure they're in a better social environment, but the goal for people that we're seeing that's moving up and coming to stay around these mines just in hope of securing a job. So in terms of the challenges that the country faces and the role that we can play as big employers, we are acutely aware of that. And in fact, we are spending more and more in this environment, because if we don't, we also understand that it influences the productivity levels on the mine. It affects the social standards that our people live in, because they live in these communities. So we've got a responsibility. We acknowledge that responsibility. I think the challenge is, if we spend that money smarter by working with government and other social partners, I think we can get better bang for our money. But in terms of, do we know that we are responsible? Do we acknowledge it? And do we go the extra mile in trying to make a difference? Certainly from Impala Guard and from what I'm seeing from the other companies, I can assure this committee that the platinum industry is very serious about their commitment.
All right, let's pick up some speed.
Okay,
respond to the remaining questions.
Quickly as I can, Honourable Member Bigelli, just on slide 14, you talk about housing, generating housing. Mr. Ronja mentioned, for example, the $1.7 billion that's been spent in the last 5 years, I think it is 5 or 6 years, is excluding housing. And we're just looking at the moment on red, looking at the entire housing spend. Impala Platinum alone has spent $2 billion in the last 5 years on the housing front. So the housing front actually expands that number quite considerably. But if you would give us the opportunity, we'd like to come back to the definitive numbers. I'm still working on that specific project. On the issue of strike action and housing, the underlying causes and how we're trying to resolve it.
Can we ask media? We are in a meeting. It can't be right that you've distracted the attention of people from what you have discussed. You can take the contact details after the meeting, not now, during the meeting. Please continue.
Chairman, so on the issue of dealing with the underlying causes, I think the companies across the board have obviously, initially the focus was on restoring stability and engaging in a way which would result in outcomes of getting workers back to work and restoring peace and stability into the workplace. That was very much the focus at the end of last year, and I think a lot of that was very successful. Our focus this year has been very much on engagement. It's been engagement with all the unions, not just with one union or two unions. It's about and governments through the Department of Labour have intricately been involved in the process. So, for example, in the platinum sector, there's been an engagement process. The Department of Labour, the Department of Mineral Resources have played a role looking at centralised collective engagement in the platinum sector, and that role has been trying to get all the unions to be part of the engagement process and to constructively engage within the rules and system that we work with. So just to highlight to you, the Department of Labour has played a very constructive role in those types of challenges. In dealing, obviously 2013 is a labour negotiation, their wage negotiation, yes, so there's going to be, obviously the unions will come back with their views and ideas, and I think hopefully achieve a stable, predictable environment in the next year in the platinum sector from the events that are taking place. On, if my colleagues are not adding to that, very quickly, on the issue of the retrenchment and avoidance mechanisms, I think all the companies obviously are looking very carefully at how they try and minimize job losses where possible. It's very much a strong commitment on the side of the industry, and that's either through redeploying labor by making sure that the social and labour plans that are constructed, the social plans in particular, can help cushion the blow of retrenchment when it does take place. And there's been, I think, some very innovative thinking that's gone into that particular area. On the media side, Honourable Chairman, one might not have heard too much about what's been happening, but MEGDES itself was the, we talked about when it was established and some of the work in the main MEGDES side. I think in terms of LIFEN, I think it's a platinum task team. There are other task teams that work within the MEGDES structures. There's a task team on infrastructure. There's a task team on the regulatory framework affecting mining. There's a task team, et cetera, these types of task teams. And perhaps it would be a good idea at some stage to have a tripartite discussion on MEGDES with the portfolio committee, you know, just to take you through all the different aspects of it, because I'm not sure that we'll have necessary the time here today, but it's a very vibrant, engaging, challenging area to be involved in, because, but I think ultimately everyone's trying to achieve the same thing, and that's what's in the best interest of the country. I think what's certainly coming out in that particular discussion. So if we relate it back to the mine Lekotla, I don't think it's an overlapping or duplicating structure. The ideas that have come through from MEGDES have certainly fed through into the mining quotas side. So I think it's more synergistic than it is mutually exclusive. And then on that issue of how we attract investment in the sector, I think the critical thing is restoring stability, predictability to the sector, getting the collective bargaining, getting the industrial relations environment smooth, and working together as a collective government, business, labour, we can get this platinum sector back on its feet because it's obviously very challenged at the moment. I think that's what investors want. They want this stability. So I think that's very much part of our equation.
Anything
else? Just Honourable Member Paulo, asked a couple of, I've just got one or two remarks there if you want to put in.
No, Chair, I just wanted to make a request that the PEP also have an opportunity to call in with this for further engagement based on the fact that we wouldn't have enough time to understand.
Honourable Chairman, then on the last couple of questions around the way forward, it's obviously critical to restore confidence in the sector, and obviously I think everyone's efforts are focused in this particular area. I haven't met any of the platinum chief executives or companies that are not committed to the future of the platinum sector in South Africa and the country as a whole. So I just want to give the absolute categoric assurance that this is a sector that's committed firmly, but yes, we're in crisis at the moment, but the long-term investment plans that we talked about and the debt capital that's being raised to try and fund longer-term projects, etc., is just an example of the significant commitment that the platinum sector is making, the platinum companies are making to the future of the industry and to the future of the country. In terms of our current standings of where we sit on the platinum side, South Africa currently accounts for 50% of platinum supply. So it's the biggest on platinum, it's the second biggest on palladium, and it's the biggest on rhodium. On palladium, we're about 27% of supply, and on rhodium, we're about 62% of supply. So we are a big supplier, but scrap supply alone is now one of the biggest suppliers after South Africa and Russia. So just give you an example of how the structure of the market has also changed at the same time. Thank you, Jim.
Do you want to make an addition?
Just to add some of that last point that Roger made, I think it was a great question. Are we still number one in the world? And the way I'd like to frame it is that we've got in the Bushveld Igneous Complex one of the greatest, if not the greatest, ore body in the world. It's the greatest ore body in the world. Platinum, palladium, rhodium, ruthenium, iridium, chrome, gold, silver, copper, nickel. And you couldn't wish for a better ore body if you were a country. The question, I think we've been addressing in various ways, how do we turn that into wealth for the country? And it feels like to me, and I think many of my colleagues, that we've got a Premier League asset. You know, we've got the Barcelona Stadium, we've got the Soweto Stadium, we've got the Manchester United Stadium. But as a team, and when I say a team, I mean, you know, as regulators, as industry, as labour, as communities, we seem to play like a third division team. And yet we've got this marvellous asset that we simply can't get our hands around and say, how can we turn this into wealth for the country? And I'm going to the issue of, you know, substitution and are we number one? We are not the judge if we're number one. I think it's the various stakeholders, both in the world markets, world investors, our own employees, labor, communities, society who judge us as to whether we're number one. And they judge our performance on how we've done. And I think we have to ask ourselves, are we doing justice to the all body that we sit with? So while we're in crisis, and as you said, you know, is it a catastrophe, can we pull back from the precipice? I think what you're hearing here is enough commitment and ideas with the association and the very rosy future that PGMs holds. But can we get our game together to demonstrate to the world that they will vote as number one? It's not for us to vote if we're number one. So restoring confidence of labour and our employees, that you know they trust us to get a good part of the dispensation. Are we doing enough on that front? Our communities, are we doing enough on that front? It would appear not. Certainly from the point of view of investors who are going to put the money in to enable us to do this, you know, you're hearing from many of us that we have to go cap in hand to get money from them and say, please trust us, we think we will get our act together. From the point of view of our customers, you know, the issue of substitution on platinum and rhodium is not by accident. Have we got the confidence of the world's markets and customers to be a reliable supplier of platinum and rhodium? Right now, I don't think we have. And the reason that we're seeing, you know, very, very large falls in rhodium revenue is because it's been injured around the cattle. Why? Because rhodium comes from Africa. And the volatility in prices caused people to go to palladium. So we're competing with Russia, with North America, with Zimbabwe, and with recycling in Britain. And as we, as, you know, it's us as a country that have to compete with that. We've got the best asset, we've got good players in the team, but to stop this substitution and to stop eroding our market share and just in platinum numbers, it's gone from 4.6 million to, you know, to 4 million. That's a 15% reduction in market share that we've got. How do we stop that, reverse it, and get going? And if, you know, beneficiation, I think, was the other question that came. One small example, Chair, we've got catalytic converters that are being made in this country, the very same companies that make catalytic converters, notwithstanding what Chris said about, it's Johnson Matthey, it's BASF, it's Umicore, it's Horizon, it's the same people that make catalytic converters. That's been a success story in beneficiation. But what happened now is the incentives for that have actually been taken away. So we go backwards in beneficiation on the MIDP to the APL. We're going backwards the country on beneficiation because of the collaboration that needs to take place, particularly interministerial, Department of Labour, Department of Mineral Resources, Department of Finance, Department of Science and Technology, in order to create the environment for beneficiation. So we've got those chances to do it, and we can reverse it. But we've got to get our act together as being a Premier League, being one of the third division. Because we sit with one of the great assets in the world.
I think in the flow of his input, he took care of my question. Very interesting, another thing we need to understand. I think in your presentation, Roger, you made mention of a need for us to shape our research and development component so that it can add value into the equation. How is it affecting it? I understand the thing that is not there amongst the stakeholders. But how is our research and development pulling us down in the
I'm going to take this and this is a critically important question because R&D and further market development are intricately linked to the future success of the platinum sector in the long term. There are a number of initiatives that are in progress, the Advanced Metals Initiative, the Hydrogen Initiative, and a number of others which are looking at different components. Are we doing enough? No. Are we collectively as a country doing enough? No. Do we need to promote the idea of setting up a platinum valley like they've got Silicon Valley in the United States, where we put in place as a country a set of incentives to really encourage the knowledge institutions like the research, you know, the state-owned and private research institutions to do a lot more on the R&D front, to encourage universities to dedicate students into areas looking at research and development related to platinum. Answer all those questions, those are ideas. Are we doing enough? The answer is no. Can we do more? We can do a lot more collectively, but it has to be a collaborative, collective effort, in my opinion.
Okay, you Charlie, you would have expected that we ask this question from you, Anglo Platinum, the announcements that you have made about possibilities of shedding 14,000 jobs, what is the status of those announcements? You have had engagements, various stakeholders, as recent as, I think last week, you had a meeting, I think at a meeting level, or yesterday, I don't know when, last did you meet, but it would look like that you're meeting frequently. But we need to know what is the status of that situation. That's one question. The second question would be, in the slide, Mr. Bester, you showed us that you are moving in a loss-making mode in terms of the number of companies. You showed us a slide there that indicates that indeed this is the situation, and your colleagues in various companies have confirmed that they had to go back to shareholders to ask them to put more funding into various projects. Now, what is the intention to turn that situation around so that you can go back to profitability levels as it was before? The other question is, the third one, would be the causes of these illegal strikes. You've indicated that you have been affected by these illegal strikes to certain levels, but you have not discussed with us fully the causes of, in your understanding, of these illegal strikes, and what are we going to do to prevent these illegal strikes from happening into the future. We'll ask the question to the unions as well, but I think now that you are before us, let's probe those two questions. Can you answer those?
Honourable Chairman, I think I'll answer the first one because that's directly related to Anglo Platinum. Chairman, so we announced the proposal as to what we were doing around two key areas. One was around returning certain operations, which is actually in line with your second question. What are we doing around returning certain operations to profitability? And secondly, what we as Anglo American Platinum are doing around aligning our business to the market demand. We announced these proposals sometime in January. We have now stopped and the process. Normally the process would start, it would start with the Labor Relations Act process. So normally when you're starting the lawsuit, when you commence, when you contemplate any retrenchment, you start the Section 189 process. So we needed to do that. What then we agreed with the DMR and actually with the Department of Labor was that we would put that process on suspension for 60 days. We would then, with the DMR, in a tripartite way, in a MIGDEF way or a tripartite way, with our unions and associations and the Department of Mineral Resources, that we would engage for 60 days. We would share what our plans were, we would share the difficulties, we would share all our information around the market. We put all that information on the table and how and why we got to the conclusions that we got to. In that 60-day process, there also be an opportunity then for unions, associations, and the DMR to put forward what they think any alternative plans to that process may be. So if, for example, someone said, oh, I think we could help return these operations to profitability in the following way, then, you know, we've consistently said, because these are proposals, that we would certainly be open to any of those type of considerations. So to answer your question, Honourable Chairman, we are in that process now. So we've had a number of meetings, we've had a number of initial presentations. Last week we had Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, very detailed presentations. So for example, we had six different work streams that were presented on. The day one was all around the market. We had independent experts come and present at that meeting. Then there was another day around the finances and the mines, so to say, well, share what the nature of the financial situation of the company was. It was also a day on how we reconfigure operations in Rustenburg to make it more profitable. And then the final day all had to do with people implications. And we also shared the proposals of our social plan, which is a plan that we are proposing to help if there are to be people affected by retrenchments or people that have to be redeployed within Anglo-American South Africa, then what those programs could look like. So we made that clear right from the beginning, is that if there are people implicated by the restructuring, and there will be, then what are we doing as a company to demonstrate how we, to the best of our ability, offset, number one, create jobs for, they might not all be money, they might not all be with Anglo-American government, but what are we doing then to link with other programs in the country, things like the President's housing plan in Rustenburg and infrastructure plan. So how do we link with those kind of plans to offset any potential? So those are the presentations that were made last week, Chairman. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, there's a more detailed data gathering room because people keep saying, no, I want more information, I want more information. But you can't, you can't just dump information because otherwise people won't be able to make sense of it. So we keep going into more and more detail. And what we're doing is now creating a data room in the company. We're doing that this week. And then there'll be visits to the data room by all stakeholders. So, I mean, that's just a very long answer, Chairman, to say that the process that we've agreed on, 60-day process with unions and associations and the DMR, we're in that process now. At the end of the 60-day process, if there are, if there's no sort of knight in shining armor that managed to come up with a really great alternative, we would then have to commence with the 6189 process, and that's another 60 days. So really a very focused 4-month process as we speak now of consultation and going through process. So that really are on that process, yeah?
Is it a consultation because it's necessary that you must consult? Or are you confident that in this process there's a likelihood that you will find a solution? Because for you to shed that much work in so much jobs, 14,000, on top of the rate of unemployment which is so high in the country, quite a shocking situation. So are you confident that indeed through these engagements there's a possibility that those jobs will be saved? And how many shafts are affected? Are they affected as the shafts completely, or is it part of shafts that are affected? And what are you thinking in terms of putting those shafts up for small-scale operators who do not necessarily have overhead like you have as the major employer?
So, Chairman, you asked the question, am I confident that these processes will save all these jobs? I'm not confident at all, Chairman. I need to be honest that the fact is we've spent the better part of last year going through all these, all the possible iterations. The fact is that, remember, we already in 2010 went back to our shareholders to ask for a very significant amount of cash. This has been an industry in crisis for a long time now. So we've been working through that. I think we've done some of the, easier stuff. So can we make, can we focus on productivity and can we do this and can we do that? And I think it's important to note that this is not just about, people must work a bit harder and all of a sudden all these problems will go away. This is an industry crisis, Jennifer. And I think we've done a lot of work thinking through what those possibilities may be. There may be some things that we've overlooked. There may be some things that that we as a company can't do, but as the government we can do, or as a reserve bank we can do. And there have been separate discussions around that. But us as a company, I think we've had a look very closely at what we believe we can do. So no, I'm not confident, Chairman, that we're going to have some clever idea that said, all you have to do is think about that and all this problem goes away and Anglo Platinum all of a sudden will become profitable. So, I'm being honest, but I think it's important and the same thing is, even in those discussions that we're having, because you can imagine they're very they actually often aggressive conversations. They say, oh, you mustn't do that, you mustn't do this, you must do that, you mustn't do that. But you know, the aggression won't change the fundamentals of what we're dealing with. So we are open to suggestions, and there are some discussions now at a MIGDET level with the under top team that we spoke about underneath MIGDET that's working on the same. Well, as a platinum industry and as government, aren't there some other things that actually the company can't do? Now that is, those discussions are taking place, and there may be some opportunity, Chair, but I think a bit too early to say. And remember, we're not just shutting down stuff, we're reorganizing our operations in Rustenburg so that we can make other operations that are currently loss-making profitable. We had, every single operation in Rustenburg last year, with the added impact of the strikes, every operation in Rustenburg and Union Section and one of the operations at Amandelbult. So we have 80% of our operations in the whole of Anglo-American platinum, the world's biggest producer of platinum. 80% were loss-making last year. If we took away the impact of strikes, we probably would have had 30 to 40% loss-making. So that graph that Roger showed of all the different mining companies stacked up together is currently showing an average of last year's price at 50% of platinum industry loss-making. So is there just us saying, well, we get, you know, you forgot about this or you forgot about that all of a sudden the industry is going to become profitable? I think the answer is no, Jim. We have some hard times ahead of us, and I think that there's many factors that will help, that could potentially help us, but it's not going to happen in the next 1 or 2 years. I think we are in the platinum industry facing a time that that it's going to be difficult. And a really big issue that we spent a lot of time talking about today is the fact that that these costs are going like this, and the prices stay like this, and the prices are staying like this because the market's oversupplied. You know, those are real fundamental issues. So anyway, we've spoken about that, Chairman. The fact is that Rustenburg, we're not just chopping some stuff and putting some stuff on the side that we're not mining. The reality is in Rustenburg, we're reconfiguring our operations so that we can make what we have got profitable. So it's not little mines out there that we can sell. We are looking at, there have been some requests from Impala for us to look at some of the areas. They've got shocks, but is there something we can do to that prolong some of these? We'll have those conversations. We just haven't been able to have those yet. But I think it's important to know, Chairman, that they're not big portions of these shocks that are waiting there to be sold to someone else. And also remember, we have a responsibility that we don't want to sell the scrap to someone else to want to make a profit.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
No, you didn't answer the second part of my question. How many shafts are affected?
Yeah, so we've got...
The entire shaft, or is it part of the shaft? And what are the thinking in terms of the small scale of coming into the city?
Just to answer that, Chair, is that in Rustenburg, in the Rustenburg East area, you picture that on this piece of paper, I mean, in the past we've had either it was split into two mines, or it was split into three mines, lately it's split into five mines. We're going to be taking the Rustenburg lease area back to three mines. But because we have certain areas that we're mining in that area that is loss-making, we're stopping some of the areas in that. But we're making, by giving certain areas, we chop them up into what we think is two small blocks. If we have to stop some of the, for example, some of the UG2 operations, which are loss-making. So some of the shafts have got Marinsky and UG2, for example, we would stop the UG2 operations because they're loss-making. And then give them more Marinsky to make them viable. So on that piece of paper, if you picture that as the Rustenburg lease area, we will be rearranging lease area into three mines, stopping some of the loss-making areas on those, giving others more scale so that they themselves can not be loss-making but can profitable. So there's not pieces of this that we can say to a small-scale miner, why don't you take this section and why don't you take that section? So the answer to that question is that four shafts will be affected, but they will be reincorporated into that lease area. And then, of course, because some of there's less production coming out of Anglo-American Platinum, we'll be shutting down two concentrators or putting them on care maintenance. Roger, you want to talk about the cause of the legal strike?
No, I said 20, we have different questions. I'm letting you just stay one for me.
Thank you.
Well, you're just answering the, completing the question, Chair.
On the labour strike issue, I mean, obviously there's a, in my thinking, I'm not a labour market expert, but in my own thinking, and some of the thinking that the Chamber's done, I mean, obviously there's a multiplicity of factors. It's a very multifaceted, multi-tiered set of causes that contributed to the illegal strike activity taking place and to the associated marches, the issues around high rates of urbanisation, high youth unemployment, within the workforce itself, specific challenges around getting large support bases to support two households, migrant labour system. There's a multiplicity of different factors coming to it. I mean, one could even go as far as looking at the large exposure of mine workers to credit, as an example, and the garnishing orders that have been, and I think the national credit regulators are looking at a number of financial institutions for maybe overdoing that angle. And its impact on mine workers' ultimate second pay. Because at the end of the day, you might have a mine worker who has a roster operator is earning 12,000 rand a month, but after all the punishing orders, et cetera, he might be taking home 2,000 or 3,000 rand a month. And that's been one of the big challenges. So even amongst the mining companies, there have been efforts to try and help on the providing a degree of input to mine workers on the understanding of how to deal with credit to make sure that workers don't get too indebted. So, you know, there's a multifaceted set of issues that contributed to the strike activity. Your question, how are we preventing this in the future? I think engagement, and it's about getting all the parties to play a role in the collective engagement process that we're talking about. And that's including ANCU and others, part of the discussion process of getting all the unions involved in the discussion process so that we can make sure that we identify where problem areas are and look for solutions. Because I think collaboratively we can do a lot more than what we saw in the recent period. My colleague, Dr. Lee Stratum, obviously wasn't able to attend this meeting specifically because she's involved in a discussion on this exact issue at the moment, Honourable Chairman. I unfortunately don't know enough detail of exactly what happened yesterday and today, but I know there's been a lot of work. Mr. Griffiths did mention it earlier about getting all the different parties on board and making progress with the different unions to get more stability back in the industry. In terms of the question about, you've got the challenges on board. We certainly think that you've got the MIGDES, you've got MIGDES as one structure which is critically important to helping to resolve the challenges. Parliament can play its role. Ultimately, this is a stakeholder-driven approach to the solutions of the industry, and government has to play its role, and it's going to have to play its role as an owner of ETCOP, as an example. I mean, government is 100% owner of ETCOP. You know, do we think that the dividend from ESCOM is solely a standalone investment grade rating company for ESCOM, or do we think it's also a literacy price that helps the development and industrialization of South Africa? I think it's an interesting question to ask. So government has a role to play. Industry certainly has a very important role to play. Government has a very important role. Labor, communities, etc. So I think we're looking at it very, very much more. We're not going to solve the problems ourselves. We need to do it collectively. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to quickly add to what Roger has said. There are a number of complex reasons why we had this, and Roger has actually covered some of them. I would obviously actually attribute this to the fact that even yesterday there was a meeting. What has actually sort of transpired in the immediate short-term past is the actually emergence and the rise of ANCU in the platinum sector has actually caused tensions, and I think when a new union comes into a industry, obviously before they come to some kind of settlement, there can be some kind of tensions taking place where they're actually fighting for space, for recognition or something like this, space for membership and other things. And I think the platinum sector is actually going through that phase right across all the companies. What then happened recently, while we had this meeting yesterday, was that we saw an emergence of that yesterday where a group of employees went and actually confronted that led into violence, confronted members or officials of the NUM. And that caused violence at the platinum. And yesterday, we sat down, chaired by the minister, trying to find a resolution to come to peace. try to find a resolution to say, but we can coexist even if we are different unions. That is what we are trying to do, and that is what I think Elise, Dr. Elise Tredom is trying to actually follow through. Because when I left yesterday, they were busy trying to say, can we have a special team that is going to look at endorsing and settling the issue of tolerance towards one another, one, but working under peaceful conditions, understanding that there's a right to associate and the right not to associate. Those kinds of things are actually sort of happening. But it's happening that way, and it's not only happening in Platinum. The Emergence and MCO trying to make itself present, felt in various communities. And you would have seen the uprising that took place, or the unrest that took place at Kusasalitu, which led to management closing down that shop, and eventually, simply not because of operational challenges, simply because of the rivalry between the various unions. And that, to me, has contributed also to the challenges that we're facing in terms of industrial relations. And we're working very, very hard with the support of the Department of Labor. We would recall that just after when Marikana occurred on us, the Minister of Labor set up a task team to actually look at the process of trying to see how we can work together, and a peace accord was signed. And obviously, those are going to be difficult situations, difficult negotiations as we go forward, because people are talking for position and people don't want to move from their current position. I just recall yesterday where one party was saying, but the issue of recognition, and we tried to move away from them. We tried to say, let's concentrate on peace issues. Yeah. That's what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Chair, if I may, you just contribute or build on what my colleague said here. I think if we take a step back, specifically around Marikana, I mean, I'm probably one of the only people in the room that saw the evolution of those events and my colleague was there. What we saw was an absolute tragedy. I think in responding to everything since then, as London, you would have seen on the 31st of January at our annual general meeting, he launched key strategic initiatives, change initiatives. And one of those was around employee relations and what we touched on, which is this recognition framework. I mean, it's clear that people want to have a voice at the table. It's clear that we need to work on something that's inclusive, proportionate, and, is based around consensus decision-making and have everybody kind of at the table and aligned around broad agreement. And I think if we focus on that as we move on, we may see that harmony comes back into our industry, because it's absolutely crucial. I mean, a lot of those people that are affected on the ground, I mean, I haven't even younger than myself. It's absolutely true. If you look at the average age of our workers, at 49 or 10, I don't know what the situation is in Bala or Anga, but certainly at London. And the subtext of all of this is people want a voice. They want to be heard. And they have to be represented at the table. And I'm just looking at to say, the solutions that we are coming up with at London revolve around that. A new dispensation, a new framework that talks to inclusivity. Because there's no way you can move forward. I mean, Honorable Brian spoke earlier about how is the Department of Labor helping you. You know that to end the debt that we had for Marikana, I mean, the Department of Labor was instrumental. The CCMA was there on the ground. We were there. And this is crucial, and it comes back full circle to the point about this collaborative report. Chris touched on it. I think Mr. Tarrant touched on it. Albert Jameson touched on it. We need to get our team working as a Premier League team. And they're starting to do those things at London. Thank you.
Yes?
Thanks, Chair. Perhaps I could just add, because this is a very important subject. I think what we've heard in the media, quite a bit in reflecting over the strikes and the events, is a lot of blame. Everybody has been blamed. Employers have been blamed, unions have been blamed, inter-union rivalry has been blamed. The blame doesn't take us to the root cause and to the solution. I think what is required is introspection, and for all the parties to acknowledge where we've made mistakes, and where we've been past each other, and where we could have done things together. And personally, and from an Impala perspective, I can categorically say, with the benefit of hindsight, there are issues that we could have handled differently,
And it's possible to now see that there were things that perhaps we haven't done as well as we could have. But at the root cause, I think what we're speaking about here now is very, very important. Our labor legislation is written and it foresees a majoritarian kind of approach where it foresees one or at best two unions operating as an operation. The history in South Africa is also such that we've had one or two large unions as an operation. And workers are used to that. The stakes are incredibly high. If you think about Impala, 50,000 people. If you're the majority union, then you are the only union that operates there. The company makes resources available. We will appoint 120 full-time shop stewards. We'll upgrade them. We'll give them offices, transport, cell phones, CCs. They don't have to dock in. They've got freedom of movement. This is the culture of where our labor dispensation has taken us. So in terms of losing that position and all of those benefits, it's no wonder that shop stewards and leaders in unions are prepared to fight hard to retain those benefits. It's also no small wonder that emerging unions are prepared to fight hard to gain those kind of things. Right now we are all trying to establish a more democratic, more open dispensation and operation. And we're doing it through consultation, through talking to the different unions and saying, let's all agree to lower thresholds, to a different way of working, a more sustainable way of working. But to get that agreement, we are determined on those parties agreeing. All saying, yes, we acknowledge there's been a problem in the past. Yes, the future has to be different. We are prepared to change. The legislation is not on our side. It doesn't provide for lower thresholds, more open, more transparent, more unions in a more democratic way. So to get to where I believe we need to go as an industry and as a country, where the shop floor is more open and people can express themselves more freely and change more freely, it's not embedded in our legislation. So unless there is a willingness from all the stakeholders to accept that the future is embedded in that, but the jury is still out because we haven't signed one of these agreements and we haven't been able to do one of these agreements. But as long as the stakes are as high as they are, the people involved will go to great lengths to retain power or to get into power. And I think that's the challenge we have as a mining industry.
Let's put this into perspective. The Labour Relations Act intention originally was to ensure that there is stability across the industry. And you can't have stability if you have a plethora of unions operating in a particular company. The reason is very simple. Who do you agree with on the way forward in terms of whatever you're talking about? Look at the issue of wages, for example. One union will agree with you 10%, the other union will want to agree with you 15%, the other union will want to agree with you 8%. Where are you as a company? So the Labor Relations Act, before you tear it down, you need to look at what was the original purpose of that act. Was to ensure that there's stability. But also the other side was to ensure that we don't apply the divide and rule principle. Because you will take one union on one side, agree on certain things, and use that against the other union, and that permeates down to your workers. And your workforce then starts doing what they are currently doing as we speak. Look at the issue of UNCO and Lonely. They came out very enthusiastic to say that they have concluded a 2% wage agreement. Meanwhile, it was not so. It's only 12% of the real wage increases that have been effected. So they then said to workers, we've got 22%, more workers when they see it on their pay market. It's basically 12%. Now, imagine that situation happening, through different unions that would be formed in a particular place. I'm not saying labor relations that cannot be changed. If the need arises, it should be considered, but let's look at why do we want to change it. What will that do into the future of the situation in terms of stability and shown instability in our labor market. But yes, fine, I think we've heard what you said. Let's hear what are your counterparts going to say in form of the union on the crisis in the platinum sector. But I assure you that we are very concerned. And if there's anything that Parliament can and should do, don't hesitate to raise it with us. And I'm sure that this committee will be very much willing to consider and get involved at some stage. What we didn't want to do was to interfere with your other engagements. We allowed you space to engage as much as you could on finding lasting solutions. But if time arrives that Parliament must now get directly involved, we will definitely do so willingly in our side. So let's thank you very much for coming. Oh, you want something to say?
Before you go, Chair, that's one point. It might be mentioned in there. In the mining sector, we work underground. We work under conditions that want us to always recognize safety. And we are actually practicing that even in our offices. For some of us who come to complex offices like this one, we do want to have a quick office induction about safety. In the unlikely event of any eventuality, these are the routes that should take. I'm sitting in this office, Chair. Number one, I don't know how I got in, but I had to be guided. Because it's all the different corridors. I think it would be injustice or it would be wrong on our part to talk about safety, because we have made it our culture to talk about safety everywhere and even in our offices.
That's
what I wanted to make. Guided again when you go out. No, next time we will give you some induction. You want to say something, Mr.
Berger? Well, Jim, just a final word of thanks to you and the honourable members of the committee for giving us the space and the time to have an open, robust discussion about the challenges that we face. And we sincerely appreciate your commitment to working with us. And if you're needing it, you know, we can try and think of which you can play a role in helping. This is a great industry which is going through crisis. But collectively, together, we can do more. So I just wanted to say thanks from our side.
Thank you very much. Let's then, on that note, have a 5-minute body break in line with your safety, health and safety, Mr. Mugaina. And then when we come back, we listen to the National Union of Mine Workers.
I'm not going to
I don't know. I'm I want to thank you for the time. Salary adjustments So they will put a demand ranging from 12.5 to 18.5. Now on its own, a demand by mine workers for a higher salary pay is justified on the basis of the remuneration level that mine workers have. But what we have as a problem is the method and the approach on the current demand. Here is the method. First, the demand is done when there is no bargaining process. Secondly, concurrent with that, people who are demanding are telling you in after service, that, they're telling the platinum company that, please be informed, we are not going to work tomorrow. They demand today, concurrent to their demand, they resume an illegal strike. So an uncollected strike in a language of a trade unionist like me. Some are led by workers' committees, and some, though very few, depending on the region, are led by the MLF itself. We led the same strike in Matosana region where I'm coming from. And before any matter is second of a strike and a demand for a higher wage, you have a second demand on day two. And if they said to you, they want money today, and they're not going to work. Tomorrow they tell you, no, by the way, we are not represented by a union. That's the second demand. And then they would say, which has something to do with, and you know, they would then mobilize to resign in mass from the union. Before they even go to work, they are already being organized or recruited for a union, not registered or active in that particular operation before going to a strike. That's what is being done. The third one is that they now are given a political home. When they went to a strike, the reason was money. And remember, when they are mobilized to move away from NLM combat services, they are told that one of the reasons why you must leave NLM is because it is more political than a trade union. It is no longer focusing on trade union issues, but being preoccupied with political issues. But on the third day of their strike, they have a political home, which therefore suggests that in actual fact, it is not wrong for mine workers to have a political home sometimes. But what is being presumed as being wrong is a political home to the ANC. That you can have any other political home, but for as long it's not the ANC, because at the process, they on start on day three, there's a new political home. They will tell you, please be informed, we're no longer interested in the ANC. We have an organization. That's what is happening. With the miners there. We're not going to go to salaries. But the fact of the matter is that if we were to check to the whole economic sector and do an analysis of the salaries and minimum level, you would find that if the revolution, quality revolution for one, was meant for salaries, it would have not started in mind because they are not the least remunerated. Though they are not remunerated at the level they deserve. So the issue that it's not necessarily premeditated by the issue of salary, affair. Some of the issues we can raise them, but we can't raise them in the portfolio committee public. We'll raise them in the study group of the ANC because they are too political to be served with involvement of opposition parties and meetings. So the method and consequences, method one is high level of intimidation, violence, anarchy, demagogy, brutal killings, primitive mentality, unprotected strikes, mining, recruitment, strategy, vessel travel, or ethnic chauvinism. The method there, here, we're not raising anything that it has to do with the cost of a recognition argument. Because if the company feels that the recognition argument that it has with a particular union is costly to the company, that particular company should seek to review the recognition argument in terms of the resolution. Impala can create chaos in the mining industry. And then come here, motivated that on the basis of how expensive it is to have a number of full-time job stewards, have offices for them, and have a laptop for them. They can't do that. They should have gone to a union that they had a problem with cost of a recognition agreement. and that they should address that issue instead of them using campaign processes to impose anarchy in the industry. We'll explain when we're going back as to the centrality of Impala. If you can remember, people died more in Lomé. And the chaos now is in Amblas. We've never had any instance where the union says, take away Lomé's license, because we know Lomé as the company had not been central in the chaos. The same with Andrew Butler, but we've been arguing that Impala's mining license must be revoked. We're going to argue that even on motivations check. Now, if you can see to these things, none of them dictate an operation of a union. In actual fact, if we were to be practical, you are all MPs because people voted for political parties. Anyone who wants to come to parliament must come to parliament to vote. That's why we were several in rejecting the floor crossing, because it was negating the fact that we voted for political parties and not individuals. And that they can't take at any time. This is the same situation in the mining industry, where mining makers are not allowed to choose which union they want to belong to, but they are forced to 11 over intimidation, violence, and anarchy, brutal killing. But if you take in consequences, it's high levels of job losses, unnecessary and unforgetful of life. If I can tell you, when these workers are on strike and they declare that they don't want any union existing to represent them, at the time they are given a notice of either dismissal because they are in a legal strike or retrenchment after the strike, the union that is recruiting at that bush is not a recognized union. When they are forced, faced with the reality of being expelled or retrenched, the union that they claimed not wanting to be members of or represented by them must take up the responsibility to negotiate for them. And we're doing that proud, because our responsibility is not to compete as to who wants the union, who doesn't want the union. It's to protect job security of all South Africans employed and non-South Africans in the mining industry in that instance. That's why you have high levels of job losses. Because bosses are very clever. They tell you, they agree with you that those are the union, but they know tomorrow if they want to hire you, it is very thick and cheaper to do that, because you would not be having a representative on your side as a union by that time. And the image of the industry has been raised and issues by this thing. The issue that one to explain, if it's looking at primitive mentality, at the heart of the problems that he had, for instance, in London, it was approved by the commission, it's primitive belief by managers. You see, in Alan Grant, the MEC of safety in Gauteng responded quicker than any other MEC on the call when two NUA members were killed and that 20 soldiers were held hostage. And this has been claimed here that it's competition. It's not competition. To hold people hostage, it's anarchy. It's not competition. It has nothing to do with competition. And that two people were killed. The MEC responded quicker. Guess what? On her arrival, these members told us, please tell them not to come closer. Then he asked why. We remember data that she's a woman. And that they came, they used the traditional processes of tradition. And that no woman should be allowed to be closer to them, because it would then weaken their strength. So it's a primitive mentality. Primitive mentality. That even women journalists were told to be Americans, please stand there, don't come closer. Because the mentality is that they should have not been closed because they're going to weaken what they've been using. We're not saying it is right or wrong or people used it or not, but we're saying the industry must find a way of an educative campaign, possibly using anthropologists, to demystify portions of primitive mentalities that left with mine records. In actual fact, this elevator challenge has an exact claim that you know traditional. People who have used it believe that nobody could stop them. In actual fact, they are believing that their opponents drug them. And that you are told, please don't look on the back. You must fast forward. That's why it's going to be successful. So those issues must be dealt with in terms of education to demystify belief that are endangered lives of mine workers. What is the stake there? One, yeah, we are not getting here to Parliament and requesting you to install us as a minority union in a Parliament. No, we came here to tell you that there's a problem in terms of the law. One, the Constitution guarantees freedom of association. In the Constitution of the Republic, it guarantees freedom of association. The right to join a union of your choice is outlined in the Labor Relations Act. Mm. Resignation, not even resigning from a previous union. It's in the LRA and it says for a public sector union, you give 3 months notice. For a private sector, you give 1 month. Violation of human rights, brutality on murders and killings. This is where people are not just killed. They are killed and defaced. And 90% of those that were killed, it's either one or a certain portion of their party being removed. And that's because it's claimed by the industry, it's a competition between NUM and AMCU. We don't agree with that. It is anarchy, brutality, and violence. This has nothing to do with whether you say NUM or not. It has to do with how mine workers, in 2012, have been made victims of killing by their own co-workers on football game to argue for higher salaries. Why would you kill a rock drill operator if your demand is a salary improvement for rock drill operators? Because your other colleague has no power to give you the money. Mm. It is incumbent. But the second thing is, but why all of a sudden would workers who are in an illegal and unprotected strike are armed equal to be preparing for war? Why would that occur? That's why women as workers and women as members of society intersect the right to life, suspension of company policies. In Wawa, which was here, I hope they are still here. Most of managers, the fellow from Romney might know, most of managers who stood up to implement discipline in terms of the company policies had to be either bought out by the company or dismissed by a game. Because what happens in Impala is that AM could go to management, and the problem is that most of the victims are black managers. That's not what the problem too. AMCU would go to management and say, if you don't remove this manager from tomorrow, we will not be going to work. The company does not ask for the other side of the manager. The company tells the manager, you must prepare work and leave. We don't care where you're going to go. We will pay you for as long as you're not here because we want a guarantee for a production day. Someone who does not leave and stick to company, they bargain with him. They know who are the people I'm talking of. They bargain with him. They buy the person out. They even argue and say, don't care how much he wants. Let's pay that guy to leave because he is not contributing to what we're doing. This is at the center of why we are calling for Impala's mining license to be revoked. Here, they can't speak as if they're honest, Chair. Now, opposition parties, not you, they didn't even invite you. They all flocked to Lomi as that group of formal coalition of opposition parties led by GA, as I said, Mrs. Madhubu was leading them there. All that they saw there was a problem of a union called NUM, because that's what they said in their press statement. Mm. They forgot that this parliament that they are members of passed a motion in 2006 on the 24th of August, hear the motion. We want to say with you parliamentarians, your own motion that you pass in parliament. And if you look at Resolve A says that living and working conditions of mine workers be investigated further and be improved. How on earth you resolved in 2006 OCAD, and in 2012 OCAD, you assault on how mine workers are exposed to both living and working conditions in Mangin, as if you did not know. But in 2006, 6 years ago, it was you without learning who said it must be investigated and be improved. We want to remind you of the decision that you took then. You did not take time to implement that decision. Had this been implemented, Chairperson, sorry, we could have not been talking about living and working conditions as a motivation to what would have happened to Longin and other mining companies. We want to remind you so that even Pierre would remember that it was still an opposition party at this time. Now, here are the recommendations, Chair. One, we want to recommend that you work with Department of Mineral Resources to facilitate a mining endeavor. You see, this mining endeavor that we have, the one that we have here just a week before Parliament, that thing is the assertion of the bourgeoisie and the capitalist class to decide what they want to do for them to survive in the industry. It has nothing to do with either conditions of service of America or the role the industry should play in developing communities where they are mining. They were arguing about financial reality VAT here. We think that we support you. Mineral oil beneath the soil belongs to all South Africans. So anyone who has mine, they are only forests. We too qualify to get a share of the reality payment. There is no mine because we are South Africans. It must be shared across. This argument you say, reinvest it. They have reinvest profits in their companies. They have never distributed them to where they are mining. So why then they think that something reinvested by government would be distributed properly? That's the first one. So we are to ensure that please facilitate with DMR a session, mining it up. Let's contribute on how possible you could assist as Parliament in implementing your own decision, the 2006 one. Deliberate an action plan based on the housing and accommodation of mine workers. Compliance with the mining charter. Let it not be that next year, when you have to deal with the mining charter, we are all shocked that in actual fact they have not complied. Nobody detects that area that they're not going to comply. Development and standing on an adherence to a mining peace accord. We think that's fair. We are calling for Parliament to call for all unions and all companies to sign a peace accord. And there's a reason for us to do that. And this peace accord must be a platform to publicly denounce violence, anarchy, intimidation and killings as a form of organizing or union recruitment, collective bargaining. The second recommendation says that requesting that Parliament commission an independent investigation to the role of Impala. If either you request the President when the commission presents its report on Marikani, that the President extends the commission to look at Impala. Because it is not Marikana that started the problem, it is Impala and the role of the company that started the problem. Had it not been done in Impala, workers in Marikana London would have not had a belief that it is doable and that we will do it and succeed, because it was allowed in Impala, which is adjacent to London. How on earth do you allow something illegal to be done by a company, bordering with another company, and expect that workers in the other company would not demand the same? We see that this has a reason for that. The third one says, we want you to assist us, is that we don't have money in the union. If we had money, or if Parliament can give us money, we would go and petition the Constitutional Court. And just request the Constitutional Court to take as to whether in the Platinum Belt, the constitutional stipulation on freedom of association is not breached. And in other words, it was not started in Benin again. It was started in Zimbabwe. The second element there, the issue of the labor relations, human rights, and the issue of abuse of women. We want to reflect here on the abuse of women, that this gave a special visit to a man called Jautona in Kansasville. Yes. Jautona is a gold mine in Kansasville, held the gold as well. An underground female worker was, you see, women are exposed to gang rape outside. And some people even confess that they sleep with guns because they fear, and then they use the guns to kill women. An underground female worker was mob attacked by mine workers who were at work underground. One woman. You know the reason why? This fellow was attacked because she was wearing an NMT shirt. Attacked underground. All the gold Asami has not acted on those that attacked her. Hospitalized because she was brutally injured. Then, mob attacking a woman just on grounds of the woman being an NM member. And that the company does not act. And Chamber of Mines, Mr. Gusima said, says that it's competition between NM and AMCU. Forgetting that on the 12th of October, when 51 mine workers were killed, 22 of them were NUM members. 51 killed, 22 confirmed NUM members in the 51. And then we are told in Parliament that no, it's competition between NUM and AMCU. We think that please take that case as a special area where you could intervene in Parliament to restore dignity of women workers. In actual fact, Anglo Platinum, not many, they were circulating photos of three women and one man who were stood naked in public in a mass meeting, and that they were expected to move around the mob because they were still going to work. And Human Rights Commission commented and said they're not going to look on the issue now. We think that that issue should be looked at. But besides that, the issue of the right to dignity, that in the process, a mine worker is killed in front of everybody. And this is done purely to send fear to others. And it's being told that we're making a practical example of we're killing people that do not listen, so that others must keep quiet. This has nothing to do with union membership. If it is union membership, then those that are killing each other should be brought to book. The first element here is that any possibility of closing the relation, one union and joining another, again it's imbalance. Commission investigation or the review of the current budget and grading, or current grading system used in the mines. Parliament must know what is wrong in the mining industry. It's not necessarily the minimum every level. It's packaged in grading, which is wrong. It's a grading system that is wrong. It recognizes skills and not effort and danger exposed by the work. Rob drill operators are even already at very low and other mine workers. Not on grounds that they do not deserve. Shift bosses who by regulations only go underground for 4 hours are paid a danger allowance higher than what is paid to underground workers who spend 8 hours underground. And that the problem is not the money, it's the grading system that is used. That is a problem. So to crack the salary levels of mine workers, the grading system must be reviewed, the person. The last recommendations that have been set by Chamber of Mines Roger. Implementation and adherence to the Platinum Task Group and Impact Interventions in the Platinum Sector, sir. But what we want to raise here is to look to other interventions, including Section 47 of the MPRDA, When the Secretary General of the ANC came out and said that Impala Amtrak must not be allowed to mount gold mines, it was the first to hand over the license. The ANC was under attack. Little did we remind the South Africans that in Amtrak Section 47, it's a use or lose it clause in the MPRDA. So the fact of the matter is that clause, even in this process of Amtrak, either retrenching or not, should be critical that if they are not prepared to mine those mines with the current efforts they have, they must as well be prepared to hand over the license. What they own is a mine. What they do not own is a mineral. They must always be different in that because they apply to be allowed to exploit the mineral. If they decide to review exploiting the mineral and that has an impact to the socio-economic stability of the country, they must as well hand over the license so that whoever is ready and prepared to mine that mine has the right to do that. It can't be seen as free. ARM was created with that and Hamun. The escaped black-owned mining companies in South Africa today, they said the truth that Anglo Gold Assange these mines that were not profitable were sold at a loss in Alphabet to both ARM and Hamun. That's how they reacted. It can't be an exception now when you're talking of Anglo Platinum. We think that this clause should be used and that it should remain critical on this thing, sir. The last thing, sir, I want to refer you, I want to remind you that Rachel Mavula, when he was the general secretary of the Communist Party, dealt with one element called demagogy. I'm not going to focus on, or I'm going to focus, they have underlined it, so demagogy is to lie to the people about what is possible and what is not. Demagogy is to foster dependency through parliament. In this instance, it is forced through violence and anarchy. Demagogy refuses collective responsibility and collective discipline. Sometimes demagogy masquerades as left militancy, but it is always true and true reactionary. The central issue is that we need platinum and the platinum industry to be stable in South Africa. As a union, as we are playing a role in the platinum casting trade debt, we are prepared to play the role there. But what we can't allow is when the problem is now the issue of investors and no longer looking to the lines that we are losing. In answer to giving yesterday, many others did not go to work at Anglo Platinum. What was the reason? People are looking to what was the impact. They are claiming that they've lost almost 5% of what they were. I don't know those things. They're not looking to the fact that mine workers' lives were endangered by other workers and that all what should be done by the colleagues to ensure that there's no worker who appropriates a right to intimidate or kill another worker. And that should be what we are preoccupied by stopping in the mining industry. And the production should not be production through blood. It should not be that a worker dies and we are happy that they agree to go to work tomorrow because we are indeed a working day. It should be that we stop killing and unnecessary intimidation in the mining industry. It is not about competition of unions. It's about how people are recruiting in the mining industry through breaching, one, the Constitution, two, the Labor Relations Act. They are prepared for a competition, but let me tell you, you can't even compete with a pig in the mud, because that's how a pig survives. We are not specialists in competing with violence, because we have not been formed as a union through violence. We are specialists in competing health and peace and stability. All what we're calling for is for Parliament to find a way to restore peace and stability in the mining industry. If that would yield to profits, so be it, but it can't be profits before saving lives. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, NUM. And as we have agreed, let's allow solidarity to give us their presentation as well.
Did you want to add what?
Please, yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Just let me say.
Okay.
Some of the observations we have observed since the signage of Marigana and even before it, we are not even sure of the role that the industry has actually played in maintaining peace and order in the industry. As also it is enshrined in various policies that the government will have an obligation of ensuring that there is stability in the workplace. So we are not sure about that. And the second thing, the failure of the industry to implement the social and labor plan in terms of the poor and the slow pace of transformation, among other things, that's also a key problem. The other thing, the pathetic and lame excuses by the industry coming to be in crisis, which they were unable to confidently share that crisis with the trade union. And because of the strength that NUM actually has, the employers that decided to embed a systematic way of attacking the unions so that the union can then be destroyed eventually. Now the last point here, which is part of the page that was observed from the presentation that was done by the industry earlier, we very much flabbergasted here by the response of the employers. In particular, when the question was posed by the chairperson to say, are you confident in terms of the 6 days period that can actually yield into a positive result? And the most deceiving answer from the AMPLUS envoy was that he is not confident. So it is, in other words, just in time of saying we're consulting the trade union for 60 days and eventually then have another 60 days in terms of the Labor Relations Act, which for us is a major concern. That, of course, to convey to our offices, ensuring that we are going to respond formally the union in terms of what the employer's attitude is all about, just of what's currently happening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Let's hear from some solidarity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to skip a few sections that's been dealt with already. Chairperson, so the first two items I'm going to focus on, the latter part I will just briefly refer to it. In the first instance, in dealing with this matter, after the Marikana incident, there's a new, totally new labor dispensation. So we cannot divorce ourselves what happened, the build-up and what happened from there. So first of all, prior to the Marikana incident, there was an ICTED task team already set up. It was also referred to the crisis in the platinum sector. But the build-up to Marikana was a lot of violence. There wasn't a startup trade union that got involved, so we had a lot of union rivalry, as the media referred to it, but also a lot of labor unrest at Impala, at Aquarius. The end result of Aquarius is that the new trade union moved in there, came in at a time when Aquarius was really struggling. They came in with a 94% wage increase demand. The end result was the mine closed down at Everest and 4,000 employees lost their job. What happened in London, it's already well reported on, and then there was a spillover to a few other mines, Anglo, Bocconi, Rossamoni, etc., etc. So there was a whole sequence of events that followed. But what happened? What we've seen here was a new extreme form of power play. We're not used to this kind of power play. Labor relations are all about power play, and this is what we've seen. This is what we've experienced at London. Secondly, that with the highest level of violence and intimidation, together with the extreme violence that we've seen. So suddenly a whole labor relations scenario changed. This is the environment in which we need to negotiate in with the employers, and our members need to go to work. Obviously the fatal shootings that took place on the 16th of August was a tragedy, but that also changed the whole dynamics of the labor relations field of security. We've seen now how police are reluctant to get involved in security-related issues after this incident, and obviously what happened thereafter was a shock to the nation. So that suddenly, from that point of onwards, Africa and labor relations field will never ever be the same. And so what happened then, as quickly as I can summarize what happened at Marikana, the way we see it and the way it started to spill over to other mines where there is the new dispensation. There was a dominance of a lot of non-employees and disgruntled ex-employees, ex-dismissed employees from the various companies, from trade unions who were involved to use this situation. This high level of of intimidation is also a severe test, not only for industrial relations, but also for the rule of law. And it was a pity that when we got to a point where we need to sign a peace accord at Lonmin, that some of the institutions and trade unions involved were not prepared to sign a peace accord. Why? Because we've also seen what the president has been saying, that violence and intimidation get rewarded. It leads to a higher union membership, it leads to attention, it leads to quicker recognition, it leads to wage adjustment. So that got a very bad precedent being set. But unfortunately, we've also seen the rise of opportunists, populists, new movements getting involved, expelled politicians getting involved. So the end result is that the labor relations environment got very politicized again. But there are also mitigating factors we've seen in the mining industry, that it's not only politics, it's not only labor relations issues. There are socio-economic pressure, worker frustrations, indebtedness of the workers. But if you just look at the matter, we are now expected to find solutions for labor relations problems, which we don't think is purely labor relations problems. Just look at the writing on some of those placards, we see we're not only dealing with the labor relations issues, but is expected of us to resolve the matter around the wage negotiation table. The migrant labor system has also been placed under spotlight. I will get back to that. That also poses there's also certain challenges now that we obviously need to deal with again. But let's look at some of the underlying reasons, what also happens. And these are the kind of challenges and the things we need to deal with. There is the two-tier system. We have employees and contractors. We've seen it at all the mines, we've seen it at Lonmin. The contractors, they don't earn the same benefits, they don't have the other fringe benefits that the main client employees enjoy, and in the end, you know, that creates two different levels of employees. There's obviously shifts in union harmony, we've dealt with it, the high level of intolerance, it's a test for freedom association. It was mentioned, if we have to look at what happened at Amplat, that's definitely a question where the freedom of association is being tested. But the one thing for Solidarity, as a so-called minority trade union, the one thing that happened there is that the whole thing about industrial democracy has now been placed under the spotlight for politicians, for parliamentarians to join parliament. You, most probably you need 1% support. It's very different in industrial democracy. Up until now, there was the majoritarian principle where you need majority support or 50% support to have a state. And I know we may differ here from our colleagues and friends of the NUM in this matter on certain issues, but it's quite as a minority union is also good that one of the things that came out of this strategy is a threshold for either of you to look at Solidarity, the role that we play in health and safety, the role that we play in pension funds, in funeral policies, in research that we do. There's also some of the mining companies who approached us to our technical training college to take over their training colleges to train for the industry. But the fact of the matter is we represent a specific group of employees, black and white, with more skills or highly skilled, but there's actually just so much you can represent. So now with the representation by 20 to 30%, sometimes 15%, we are seen as a minority union and we are kicked out of the company. So we said the one thing from our side is that we want also for the employers to weigh our contribution and not to just make it a numbers exercise. With regard to the socio-economic issues, the migrant labor dilemma has been reported on as an issue. There are two households to maintain in quite a few instances. We've also seen that housing allowances are now being used for part of disposable income and not for housing purposes as a result of that matter. It was also mentioned the high density of workers and people. And if you follow some of the biggest sociologists in the country, you will see there's also a lot of theories, especially the Durkheim theory regarding density. The media played a role. The media had to report on these matters. They're very important. It's definitely things that happened in our country that was newsworthy. But the end result is this high media profile led to further incidents. There are a lot of the leaders who are opportunists, and they're using this instability and unrest to get their face on the TV or the voice on the radio and to influence public opinion, to boost their own profile, and that also added to it. But what are the consequences for labor relations? First of all, the collective bargaining structure is under pressure because a lot of collective agreements were honored. There were negotiations with splinter groups and worker committees. We've seen it now this week on two occasions. where worker committees or the splitter groups were part of a formal organized labor discussion, getting that kind of recognition. And why do they do it? Because the precedent has been set. You just force your way in with violence, intimidation, and then your case will be heard. And then on some occasions, recognized trade unions are sidelined. But we've also noticed through this process how difficult it was for companies to communicate with their employees, because they quite used to do all the communication through most of the time through their unions, and that was also a lesson learned. A year or two ago, we had a discussion and debate in this same committee regarding ESOPs, the employee share ownership scheme. We also believe that can play a role in part of the solutions. Kumba is a good example. I know Lonman indicated that they very soon will start to roll out that process. But the employees must take also ownership and feel that they own part of the company, and that may also influence behavior where necessary. The other negative consequences is we've now noticed that there's a whole lawlessness issue is spilling over to other sectors in the mining industry, spilling over to other sectors in the South African labor market. And we sit with a very fragile labor relations situation because of this culture of workers anarchy. But the impact on employees is huge. A lot of the intimidation, violence, changes that take place was also by dismissed employees at Lonman, dismissed employees at Impala, because they felt the financial impact. A lot of employees now lost out currently on bonuses, allowances, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just escalating, but we're also taking money out of the economy, the local economy, who is also now suffering in an indirect manner. And then obviously we've also faced with retrenchments and mechanization debates and discussions, and it's very negative by image abroad. If you look, for instance, this placard that says that foreign investors must be able to pack your bags and leave, I'll come back to that. We were on asked in Europe to go to a few presentations and to the U.S. Embassy, and regardless of the fact that I totally agree with my colleague from NUA, we must focus on the people issue, investors are very jittery. The positive thing is that we are in the process of establishing a national bargaining forum under the auspices of the Chamber of Mines, but there's slow progress. One is the new concept to the industry. We've also noticed that the very mining owners today, they first want to get their own house in order. Hunter is not yet involved for various reasons, but that obviously also delays the whole process. Then the whole threshold debate, again, that is also an obstacle, and the total instability in the platinum sector, so very likely that this year all those negotiations will still be in-house. Just in briefly, there was a question on MICTE. There was a special task in set up. I'm not going to go in detail for the last minute or two. I'm just going to focus on the commitments, that special task team on platinum. We've got various commitments, six commitments. The one is dealing with job losses. Solidarity's response is that there is, at this stage, an industry failure. There's not enough transparency from employers regarding the cost-cutting measures. We also got a feeling that some of the employers told us they're sitting and waiting to see what's going to happen at Amplet, what's going to happen at Lonman, and then only will they start to play their cards. So if there's less resistance, if they manage to retrench, then the floodgate will open. So we feel there's a lot more to come. Also, the MPRDA and SLPs make provision for future forums. It's not working well at various companies. That's also part of the obligations of an employer to own a mining license, to set up a future forum, to negotiate, to talk, to keep unions informed so that we can also be proactive. That is not focusing. One of our suggestions is that must be reviewed, and obviously the ongoing labor unrest, which is not always the involvement of employees. The second commitment that we committed ourselves to as the principals is long-term sustainable employment, retrench and growth. We can read through the rest. Unfortunately, it's also not working well. We believe the Department of Labor must play a bigger role, especially when it comes to dealing with the training layoff scheme. We appreciate the work that the department did this week with trying to get union leaders together, but we felt it should have happened a lot earlier. And then there's also where we went to the social and labor plans of a lot of the employers. There's not enough detail in it. Then the other third commitment is all about cost and cost drivers and health and safety. We believe, and it's been said over and over again, that one of the issues is that we are working against each other. There is the 60% increase on electricity supply to go to We've heard today what the impact will be. That's why we will join forces in that regard. But we also believe there needs to be more transparency for the workers. The only good news we have so far is there is an improvement at Lonmin. They had 6 million fatality-free shifts. They had 14 million fall-of-ground fatality-free shifts at least. There is a bit of good news coming out of that. The fourth commitment was to deal with platinum as a reserve asset, an alternative investment option. Today we got a bit of an idea of what is going on in that regard in the presentation that was made by especially by the Chamber. But we also believe we can fast track that. Then the fifth commitment we made to save the industry, so to speak, was domestic beneficiation. That remains a long-term initiative. Today the Chamber hinted towards some of the matters, but we believe more can be done. And I know at one stage there was also an indication that this committee also would like to set up a special workshop or have a similar discussion on this specific topic. Then last matter deals with sustainable growth and skills development. That basically flows back to the mine charter. The latter part I'm just quickly going to refer to it since it was already dealt with, but definitely there are some self-explanatory in my document. These are some of the immediate factors that we need to focus on, work on. It was already mentioned, but just to end off, after this article came out in October, solidarity was requested by the biggest trade unions in Europe, by Industry All, which is the biggest federation organization internationally dealing with mining, textile, metal engineering, trade unions and the fields we are in, and ISIC, the International Trade Union Congress, to come and do presentations to them about what is happening in the country. And I know in this article there were a few mistakes made by the journalists, but nevertheless, what we've seen and what we've realized when we traveled through Europe is that union leaders, big organizations, they're very concerned about what is going on in our country. Although what they see, what they read there, and their media is very skewed, the fact of the matter is we were told over and over again that South Africa is, and we actually attended a seminar where there was comparison drawn between China and South Africa, and they said these are the two worst places to work in. This is how bad the employers are. The end result is suddenly we find ourselves as trade unionists, we had to go and defend some of the companies there and say it's not so bad, there's a lot more to it. And that's what I tried to explain. You know, it's a very difficult, complicated environment. And Mr. Shepherdson, to end off, to say that there were a lot of solutions, also the solutions made by my friends from the NUM. These are the kind of things that we need to focus on. But what is required is strong leadership. We've seen a strong leadership from unions, leaders, strong leadership from employer side, from the chamber side, the various companies, but also from this committee, from politicians. You know, this is an area referred to in certain cases as a sunset industry, which it's not. But it's for us to decide if we're going to turn around. So, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. Secondly, let's not underestimate the challenges we are facing. And if we don't soon make it a priority for all of us to focus and to make sure that we change this industry around, you know, it will just be the detriment of the workers that the NUM was referring to, because that's where the major job lies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Solidarity. I take it as all you have. Honorable members, any questions, any comments on both presentations, the one of NUM and the one of Solidarity? Honorable Mangale, Honorable Schmidt, Honorable Lorimo, Honorable Sondo, and Dr. Antoine, please.
Thank you, it's just a comment from the first presentation by you. If there is anything that the Portfolio Committee is doing, amongst all that we do, is to care about women in mining, women that work in the mines. The problem, my daughter, is when we go there, the officers don't tell us. They don't reveal the things to us. In one mine, I'm sorry, I don't know the name, I don't know where we were. We were told, we were in a meeting with officials of the mine, and we were told by him, a known member. After everything was done, it was the last time And fifthly, I knew that they were not going to tell me that a woman was gang raped terrible thing, like I said to that woman, after raping her, they did something that I'm not going to mention. None of them told me. And what we do, whatever we go to the last level underground, the whole committee, to find out about the security of the miners. That we do. Nobody has anything to us. That is the problem. We will be seen as people who just go and come back. If there is anything that we are with women in mind, because we want these women to go and work there. This is what
he
said. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very surprised by what my Buddha's ambassador has told us here today, because it sounds like an individual is running and is not even looking back, because he's complaining about workers' attitudes and approaches. But my concern is, you know, aren't most of those members whose actions you're complaining about exactly the previous members of NUM? If so, what role do you envisage NUM to play in the education of their own members? NUM can't just stand back and say, listen, these workers are out of control, help us. Is that the impression I get from Mr. Mandela's father? It was their own workers who now turn to another union or workers' committees, or whatever the fact may be. But the level of discipline which is required in the industry is a joint responsibility by unions and management, I would guess. So, you know, how do you see unions' involvement in that issue? Secondly, what is your view, in any view, about the lower threshold? Because I'd like to hear what the argument is for or against it. So, that's Mr. Madura's answer. To solidarity, I would really like to know, because the financial book of unions are really much closed issue, except about them misreading the signs. What is the kind of average fee levy a mine worker pays to a union? I know there might be different fee levels. If so, just give us an indication, because you can multiply that by the number of union members and you find out what the income capacity of such a union is. And I'm not doing invasion, I'd just like to acknowledge as to what the capacity of unions are to facilitate training and facilitate education of their own members. And then to you yourself, what is the role of a union in regards to disciplining its members? How do you see it? Because I do not see it as union saying, standing back and saying, sorry, this is not my responsibility. What am I missing point? Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Leibman. Mr. Dombata's contribution was very illuminating as to the causes of trouble in the on the labour side of mining. You blame a lot of the problems on what you call the workers' primitive mentality. There seems to be a breakdown in trust between workers and the NUM. Why do you think that the trust has broken down? I'd like to dovetail with my colleague's question as to whether there was any education on the part of the union to workers about economic realities of the industry we're working in. On reflection, does the NUM think it was it's been a strategic mistake to align itself so closely with the ANC, given the political content of so much of the objections to the NUM? And I'd just like to finish by welcoming the NUM's commitment to freedom of association. I think it's a timely thing, and I hope that will apply at mines where NUM workers are across the country. As far as solidarity is concerned, I'd like a picture of how all this has affected solidarity members as members of a minority union. Have they been able to join the union of their choice without intimidation? Has that always been the case? Give us a picture of a rockshore operator, perhaps a migrant labourer from Transguy. Would that person, if they wish, be allowed to join solidarity? Thank you.
Thank you, Sir Preston, to both unions. I want to assure you that political opportunism cannot impeach the lives of the people. Profit cannot weigh heavier than the lives of the people. Would you, as unions, recognize in the industry, assist this committee by charting some solution as people who are directly involved, solutions that the three parties, ourselves and yourselves, would discuss towards finding an amicable solution that would stabilize the industry? That is the one. The other one, to both of you as well. You were here when the industry and those involved were saying they are making less profit. When workers have not turned up to work or have not gone to work, the less profit. So we're talking about the industry, credibility of the industry and of the country, profit, very little about lives of the people. When the workers go to work and make profit, do you think the companies share the profit with the workers that they have made when the shift is going smooth? Thank you very much.
My observation basically is that workers are losing confidence in the union, and I wonder if perhaps you are also observing that, because workers rather represent themselves rather than being represented by the union. But maybe what are you doing to restore that confidence? Because I don't think, maybe you don't see the same, or you don't see the way I see, but that's how I'm operating with things that are happening at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Milan.
Thank you, Chair. I think after the presentation that we had, perhaps we didn't satisfy ourselves in engaging because of, I'd say, more of an issue of time restriction. And unfortunately now the members of the Platinum Group have already left. So you tend to wonder if we are really working towards a solution on the issues we discussed on the table. And based on what was presented, is it not possible, Chair, that you should look at another platform as well to further continue? Because otherwise then I'd see a situation where we were just engaging here, yeah? And that's where the story ends. And have a situation where, if it's possible, have something like a public hearing, but with the communities concerned in the platinum industry, or where strikes mostly affected them, so that more can be sought out of all this information. The other worry is the fact that you get a hint that people are involved in this are also not employees of the mine. And what then happens in relation to the union members in ensuring that where there's criminal issues involved, those people are brought to book? Because nothing is really being said in terms of those who were attacked or those who were killed have people arrested in such instances. The other issue is the issue of the affected people, the people are killed underground. It then says to me that it simply means that when it comes to reporting, including the DMR, in areas of mine health and safety, we now unfortunately as part of statistics have to start showing the killings that have occurred in several mines. So that we can be able to assess the situation, because it's one area that we're really missing every time we go to the industry. All we hear is fatalities, and it appears as if it's abnormal circumstances. Those issues will have to start being, we'll have to find a way of outlining what exactly is being done in terms of those killings. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Would you care to respond to those for now?
Second time I must maintain seniority. Okay, go on. Okay, what is, look, let's just deal with this thing of workers losing confidence in unions. No, it's not true. On its own, neoliberal theory suggests for the motivation of workers not to be organized. That on its own, our neoliberalism as a basis towards mobilizing workers to believe too much individually, it's almost civil liberty right. You are on your own, you are this, so that you must not think on elements of solidarity. So it is made, in this instance, this is how it is made. You can blame anyone. This is how it is made. Workers who are peacefully members of NUN yesterday are mobilized and then mobilized on anger, and the anger is not against the command. It's against a union they are a member of. And when they march, they say, we don't want union. Before they go back to workplace, they have a union. Now, parliamentarians agree with that. And workers don't want unions. When in Amsterdam yesterday, when they were marching, they sent away with the union. Tomorrow, before they come back, they have a batch of stop orders belonging to a union. So the issue is not wanting the union, but what exactly could you use as a mobilizing tool to ensure that you have all of them behind you when you know that necessarily you do not stand what you are saying to them. That's why I placed in an issue of demagogic tendency. Demagogy in this instance as a problem. Not necessarily that workers don't want unions. In actual fact, it is motivating gay to say they don't want unions, because in actual fact, its existence, it's not for unions. It's on ensuring that if workers become individuals. That's the first one. So you can get any name of being weak or dismissive. But the first one, the matter is that if it is a demand for a pay, it is not necessarily a demand for a pay, because they do not ensure that they focus on negotiation. If it's demand, you must go and negotiate. You can't demand and be on permanent stay away because you're going to be paid for that amount. What he's saying is that the element that seems to be recognizing and silently approving anarchy. The elements that are recognizing and approving anarchy, that's the first one. The second one here on the threshold, you know solidarity. Do you not recognize solidarity is almost a cap union? It is a union organizing in a particular trade. It's unlike anywhere where it is too much general on membership. So when you're talking about threshold, for anyone, do not believe in majority? Believe in majority, but we are an organization that believes in majority. In actual fact, even if it means we are de-recognized, we are not afraid to go back and do recruitment under peaceful conditions. We want to be allowed to commit under peaceful conditions. So for unions that are trade-based, like solidarity, we've never focused on solidarity and others on the basis of how many members do they have. But we don't want to accept, remember, business here never supported the notion of unions in the Trade Labor Relations Act. They've always argued for workers' committees, in fact, workplace forums. During the time we're discussing the labor relations act, so something that you lose in the formation of the law and the law is passed, don't bring it back through back door. This element of representativity has been exploited for purposes of the views of business that it usually held them even before this thing ever began. So all our arguments separate the union that is trade based
because this membership is always going to be very small because of the number of people employed in that trade. But on our case, we do not want to be imposed to work as purely on grounds that we are allowed to do that through violence. That is the first one. Now, you're saying here there is trust between AUM and members. No, that's not true. It's not true. One thing that we have and we know is that workers should be allowed to belong to a union. But that they belong to a union should be their own choice. It's not for the first time we're saying that. That's the basis of our formation as a union. Remember, even at the time a union was formed, there was never a situation where workers were beaten or intimidated to join NUM. It has never happened. It has never happened. No workers were beaten to join NUM. So if they are allowed to join a union of their choice, so if they go and join ANCU, it is fine. It's their choice. If they go and join UASA, it's fine. It's their choice. But unions must be allowed to compete under peaceful conditions. And that if I'm allowed to come and convince you to join NUM, the next person must be allowed to come and convince you. And that it must not only be me who's allowed to come and convince you. That's the issue. The issue around profit share, it has never been active in the mining industry. In Absalpet, the industry's profitability is only celebrated by a very tiny minority, which has a race quotation in Absalpet, unfortunately, which also is a gender bias in Absalpet. So, serving with workers has not never happened at a larger scale, except what Solidarity has referred to as the only issue that at least had a promising share in Kuba Iron Ore. Others have never been active with workers. The last one is this element about some not being employed. It's real. But the problem is that politics do play a role. Remember when Lonnie and Stryker were charged? Now, I know DA will agree with me on this one. When Lonnie and Stryker were charged, political pressure was applied to change the nature of the charge. Remember? NPA said is charging them with the old apartheid law of common people. NPA. And the NPA director not just stood for that until when political pressure was applied to change the task. And the reason for that was that half of those that were in prison were not Lonmin workers. They're not even workers in actual fact. And that the argument by NPA was that it could not be argued as to why people who are not employed are actively leading a strike of workers. Go to Driefontein. The chair of that committee, workers committee, workers themselves know he's a former employee who was expelled by Goldfields. But they allow him to chair a committee of workers that is on an unprotected strike. When he says, Asini, we're not going to work, everybody agrees, but they all know that he's not employed as a person. So there's almost an element of criminality that is enclosed in the process. We are not saying our members have almost deserted the union. But the problem is, if we were to use violence to force them back, there are going to be many lives lost in the mining industry. To give you a proof, when Impala workers were told that tomorrow when you come back, you have only one choice to resign in NUM or we will deal with you. They asked our view. We told them that if it means saving your life, resign. When there's peace, we'll re-recruit you. If you can change member, union membership in Uba today, you will find that 45% of workers in Uba are not members of the union because of fearing for their lives. Because joining a union that is more polarized not to be existing, risks their lives. So not being active in killing people for joining a union. If killing people meant that killing those that were spies used by the capital is made to be similar to this one, it's not the same. Not the same. Killing an impunity of the capital could not be the same like forcing people to join a union.
And let me share with you one last question that was supposed to say, why does any members affiliate to the ANC? I've been thinking that maybe this is one of the cause of the problem. So maybe just add another question to say, MEM as an organization has long adopted the triple pattern of the ANC, which was taken by the same time, many people, not only ANC members, from this section. And we can't really separate, what happens to the flag. Because this is part of our being as a union. So it is pointless to think about whether that can be the core. So it has even called a risk that members associate to ANC as their political vote. So I thought maybe it's important to clarify. One last point in terms of the threshold. I think even the company has said earlier, and our colleague Kogel Gito has also mentioned that. But if you look at the labor rate in terms of the representation, it also requires sufficient representation, which in this case, I mean, parties at their own accord decide whether what could be defined as a sufficient representation. So in this case, companies agree with the basis at that point in time to say this could be defined as a sufficient representation, which has become a red hole. That's why it's a fight for collective bargaining process. Now, it cannot be changed overnight because agreement is respected and honored by both parties. But if a new company wants to start it, a new trade union wants to start it or demand, they must also follow the same process of engaging the company. So it cannot be changed overnight. So we are simply saying, MMS is actually important and it cannot be simply trivialized overnight.
But it means it's wrong to be associated with the ANC, but it is correct for them to be members of the socialist democratic movement. We differ with that. We don't agree because as they were allowed to leave NMS members associated with ANC, consequence out of that, they recruited the political party that was being formed at the same time when they were on strike. So the question of whether it's fine, even DA have workers who are its members. It has never had the question of whether workers should be aligned to a political party. The issue of NUM being an alliance partner, it's not aligned to the ANC. It is alliance partner because COSATU is a federation. It's part of the alliance. And in actual fact, we are not a gunboot union. We work in mines and stay in communities. And South Africa's legislation defines municipal wards across the board. So a mind is in a municipal ward. To tell us not to be politically aligned would be suicidal in us, but even the ones that were told to leave us, they are in a political party even now to prove that it is correct to be in the ANC in us. So it's called out as there.
Honorable Chair, just to quickly respond, first of all, the question regarding the union levy or subscriptions, solidarity subscription fee is 77 rand, of which 11 rand goes for growth fund, that's youth for community projects, 3 rand goes for bursaries for children of members, and 7 rand for a funeral policy, and the 56 rand that remains is then used for fund benefits and for operational costs. A lot of the other trade unions use 1% of basic salary in its cap, and I think my colleagues from NUM have the 250 rand, if I'm not mistaken, so that's the 1%. Then the role of union discipline is very difficult, like for a political party. We are a members organization, very complex to have disciplinary hearings, disciplinary processes, to expel members, to dismember. It's quite a lengthy process we need to go through, and it takes easily a month or two to go through it. But we also have a policy that if our members are involved in something that's related to criminal offense, and there's a prima facie case that they're guilty, we don't then represent, but we get an external representation in that regard. Then the question on the effect on our members during that strike period, they lost out a lot of on bonuses and allowances because only 30% is basic salary, the rest is bonus and allowance, so it was a tremendous impact
We haven't lost members, we've gained members through the process. And then your question is, can RDOs join Solidarity? Yes, 24% of our membership is, if I can use the term, entry level, the unskilled workers, all raters. So there's quite a change that they can place over time in Solidarity.
Is it easy for them to do so?
We then make sure it is, yes, definitely. But also shop stewards who will then render a service, we make sure that there's no communication problem, etc., etc. So there is quite a significant change in our membership composition within Solidarity. Then the solutions to discuss, we believe that despite the issues of the thresholds that you mentioned, that creates instability, we think there should be two accords, a productivity accord, where what the employers are asking for, but it needs to be balanced with a moratorium on retrenchment, and then also the peace accord with a clear steps that will be taken if there's a breach to restore the rule of law, and then how to restore confidence of members. We've realized also we need to focus on the bread and butter issues. That's, we've done our research and 84% of our members said they've joined the Solidarity or the trade union for protection at the workplace. That's all. That's the reason. They want to be protected. So definitely back to bread and butter issues for us, and then a higher union leader visibility at the workplace. And then I fully support the suggestion regarding public hearings on this matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, by no means have we exhausted this matter. I think we have listened to the presentation. We need to go and sift them through and decide the next step. But also to give space and room for the mining companies, the unions, and the Department of Mineral Resources to engage further on the issue of the crisis in this quarter. And thank you very much, Solidarity. Thank you very much, MUM, for setting time aside to come and present and engage with us on this matter. We have eaten into your lunch time. Let's apologize for that. And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's call any